are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, February 1st, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, joining us from the Benjamin Dixon Show, Benjamin Dixon. Also on the program today, joining us from the Chapo Trap House Show, sorry?
No worries. Wait, it was a joke that was missed in the technical difficulties, but not worth retrieving.
Virgil Texas will be here with us. Also on the program today, Trump running out of options. National emergency to build a wall may be coming soon. And speaking of Trump running out of options, announces pulling out of the INF missile treaty. Meanwhile, Senate Democratic presidential candidates declared and undeclared push an anti-nuclear arms race legislation. Meanwhile, speaking of declaring, Cory Booker makes it seven official Democratic presidential candidates. Much more to come. Sanders wants to expand the estate tax and add a new top marginal rate. Also, be prepared. Trump wants to run on late-term abortion. He will be unveiling that at the State of the Union address on Tuesday. And inadvertently, Trump shows why we need a single payer by streamlining drug prices for Medicare and Medicaid. Meanwhile, a Dem's pushing for Fed contractors to get some back pay. Republicans, not so much. And conservatives and Republicans seem really mad at Republican Senator Tim Scott for not liking racists enough. And good news, colonization of America's in 15th century offers a possible solution to climate change. It involves massive death. And lastly, Utah GOP trying to undo the voters' call for Medicaid expansion. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very exciting day. We have a couple of Majority Report audience luminaries in studio with us. Are you not drinking alcohol, are you?
No, sir.
Okay.
That appears to be Red Bull. I don't know what's in
that
the Red Bull can, but...
The biggest can of Red Bull. I didn't realize...
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even realize you made it that big. Wow. All right. So Jeff from...
You go to a bodega and get that?
Jeff from Georgia is here. Kentucky Fried Comrade is here. And then some other guys, these other guys.
Who are these guys?
It's Chris, producer of Chapo Trap House.
And friend of Chris. Wow, you guys roll deep.
FOC.
Started from the bottom, now the whole team fucking here.
They're Virgil's advance guys.
Full crew. Exactly. His advance men are there. Just a reminder, if you are in the Brooklyn area, there'll be a show at the Bell House tonight, right, Michael? Are you?
Yes, indeed.
We're good. He's wearing a press shirt today. Wow,
well, this
very
is
exciting.
Not even what I'm wearing tonight. I'm back to the tracksuit.
Oh, there you go.
Of course.
Oh, my God. Just a reminder, this program runs on the support of its members. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. The announcement today by Mike Pompeo that the United States pulling out of the INF treaty, not totally unexpected. The U.S. government has been saying that Russia is in violation of the treaty since, I think it was 2014.
2014.
With the introduction of a new long-range missile that Russia had introduced. This is a treaty that was signed 30 years ago, I guess, that basically took thousands, a couple of thousand, I should say, ballistic and cruise missiles off the board, as they say, I think. And it was supported by on-site inspections that allowed both sides to trust and verify compliance with the treaty. And Trump has decided to unilaterally pull out of the treaty. Here is Mike Pompeo explaining supposedly why.
Russia has jeopardized the United States security interest, and we can no longer be restricted by the treaty while Russia shamelessly violates it. If Russia does not return to full and verifiable compliance with the treaty within this six-month period by verifiably destroying its INF-violating missiles, their launchers, and associated equipment, the treaty will terminate.
Not sure why this is happening now, per se, and not sure what the 6 months is about either. That puts us into the middle of the summer. I'm not 100% sure what that's about, but
I'm not unconvinced that Trump doesn't want to campaign on it.
Well,
I think that.
That's why it's weird, I think, to do it now and to talk about it 6 months from now, right?
What do you mean campaign on it?
I think that what we talked about with Joseph Cirincione when I had him on a couple weeks ago makes... I mean, first of all, there's a history to this. And all Bush was trying to pull out of... Didn't he destroy the ABM treaty to do the missile defense shield fantasy? So there's a... I mean, Republican people don't like these arms control agreements. And I also think that what we kind of established this through line with Cirincione, where he said there's all of these discredited, ridiculous 50s and 60s strange love ideas that have been rebranded and are back in Washington. And he said, like, part of it is just like getting our mojo back, our vital bodily fluids. And so I think that, you know, it wouldn't be a prime thing, but I could see him saying something about we're going to have the best arsenal. In the same way, you would say, build that wall.
Yeah, that's why I just find the timing just weird to do it.
I can't tell you the timing, but I mean, I'm sure he'll hit it.
But
could it overlap with some of the? I mean, I don't usually go to the Russia place, but could this overlap with some of the heat around Russia and him being like, "Yo, you're talking about how I have a deal with Russia. I just junked this whole treaty.
No one's been heard of Russia."
I actually think that's what is driving a lot of this attempt to show that he's being tough with Russia. Frankly, I'm not sure that Russia necessarily cares. If they wouldn't
already,
be happy,
they were all under. They were
in violation.
Totally,
so
right. That's not.
This is
going to
make them not in violation. Meanwhile, Oregon's Senator Jeff Merkley, Elizabeth Warren, Kristen Gillibrand, Ed Markey, Ron Wyden, and Bernie Sanders. Along with Kamala Harris, Sherrod Brown, Tammy Baldwin, and Van Hollen were there as well. Those names sound familiar. It's because most of them are running for president. And they introduced the Prevention of Arms Race Act of 2019, and it basically calls on a series of measures. It acknowledges that Russia has broken the treaty. But it calls on a series of measures to try and inhibit Trump's unilateral move. So,
props to Ed Markey, though. He's been an arms control guy for his whole career.
Yeah, and this is going to be one of the nice things about having seven senators or six senators running for president, because they're all going to be outracing each other to do the right thing. We don't have, you know, Joe Manchin's not going to be running. And so everyone's going to be pulled to the left, theoretically, and pushed to do the right thing. Not, it won't necessarily make a big difference in terms of legislation, but in the short term. But it'll make a big difference going forward. And we'll talk about this a little bit maybe later in the program, too, because there are three or four major pieces of legislation to reduce the cost of drugs in this country that are all being presented by presidential candidates. So that's good.
And enthusiastically backed by Cory Booker. Yeah.
We'll play the video.
Come on.
We should play that video, but
everybody's got their like stick in your craw candidate, and yours is definitely Cory Booker.
I don't know. It's just that I listened to the video, and it's just like, how many takes did it take for him to like get it out to the beats of the rising music? I don't know. Folks, BetterHelp is affordable private online counseling. You get unlimited access to licensed, trained, fully accredited therapists that's perfect for you. On your phone and computer through text, voice, or video chat. They're LGBT friendly. It's great for couples counseling, anything else you're going through in life right now. All you need to do is go to betterhelp.com/majority. You fill out a questionnaire. They match you with a counselor who's perfect for you. You can start counseling today. And if you decide you don't vibe with the therapist you're matched with, you can switch whenever you want. It's less expensive than in-person counseling. You're still getting the same great help from licensed professionals. If you have trouble affording it, BetterHelp has financial aid available. You're always connected to your counselor. You have unlimited access. You can talk to them, like I say, every day if you want. You can connect from anywhere, like I say. So you're not wasting time traveling to someone's office. If you're not particularly interested in sitting in front of someone, you're also not having to sit in their waiting room. A lot of people just don't feel comfortable with therapy or have never been to a therapist. This is a good way to stick your toe into the proverbial pool of therapy. BetterHelp solves all of these problems. You can sign up right now, save on quality professional therapy by going to betterhelp.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Ben Dixon from The Benjamin Dixon Show. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Are we okay? Welcome to the program the proprietor of the Benjamin Dixon Show and one of the forces behind thenorthstar.com.
Yeah.
Benjamin Dixon. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Hey, man. Thanks, Sam, for always having me, man. It's a pleasure.
All right. So a lot of stuff going on this week. We have two new Democratic nominees or would-be nominees for president. We have a someone from the billionaire party who is running ostensibly to beat the Democratic nominee, I guess, it's been revealed. And we're theoretically still possibly looking at another shutdown, although that seems less likely. Why don't we start there, just because that's where all of this stuff, you know, that's going on, I think, is sort of that's the backdrop. In fact, I guess it was just last Friday that the shutdown ended. It seems like a long time ago. I don't think that the labor actions got enough credit in terms of the pressure they put on Trump. What's your sense of how all that went down?
Are you sure it was last Friday? Because that it does seem so long
was
ago.
Was it last
man.
Friday? It was last Friday.
That's amazing.
Yes.
That's amazing, man. We're all getting older. Like, we're aging in dog years or something with Donald Trump as president. But no, absolutely. Like, you know, the moment, I think everyone realized the moment LaGuardia said it was going to have to delay or cancel flights altogether, everyone knew that was the end.
Yep.
And that demonstrates the power of the labor unions there, of the labor force there specifically. In terms of the aftermath and you know, Nancy Pelosi getting a lot of credit, I that's what politicians do. Politicians take credit for things. She held the line. I will give her credit for this. I think Chuck Schumer would have flipped and caved in had it not been for Nancy Pelosi being as firm as she was. So if we're going to credit her with anything, I think we definitely should credit her for helping the Democrats have a backbone and a spine in this process. But
there's no doubt in my mind that there weren't members of the Democratic caucus who, I mean, you started to hear, right, some squawking about we should really take this measured. Even Tulsi Gabbard was saying that, you know, both sides are problematic. She, Pelosi, really kept her caucus in line. And yeah, I agree with you. If Chuck Schumer had any opportunity to fuck this up, he would have.
Yeah, like that's his specialty, right? So I do appreciate Nancy Pelosi for holding the line, but you know, at the end of the day, it was the labor force that with their strategy, calling in sick, and just think about like how terrifying it is to have air traffic controllers not on deck. And not at their best and not at their peak. And then they having to call out sick, you know, enough for them to have to cancel flights. That type of movement, you know, while it was so dangerous in the bigger scheme of things, it was so necessary, or else we would still be at a shutdown right now.
Yep.
So, but you know, I think we always underestimate, and not us on the left in general. We're always pushing for the labor to step up. But I think the political system right now really underestimates the force that the labor unions across the country can actually continue to be. I mean, take a look at the teacher strikes that have happened over the last year. I think
we're just over the last week. I mean, I mean, I think that they're, you know, West Virginia has voted that they're going to that they're willing to strike again. This is, you know, just months after they did before. So there is I think to a certain extent, it's a little bit contagious when people start to realize that they have power in their labor. I think it starts to becoming contagious. And certainly, you know, I spoke to those teachers at the AFT union conference over the summer in Pittsburgh, and to a person, they were all their biggest regret was that they hadn't done this sooner. And it was fascinating to just watch the psychology of this. So we had Virginia teachers walked out on Monday for the day. Denver teachers have voted to strike, but they got held off for 60 days or something. There was a state law that says that they have to wait if the state intervenes, but they're still ready to go. West Virginia, like I said, have voted to authorize another strike. So, you know, that's done in the backdrop, particularly of the flight attendant union that came out and said, the real problem is going to be when we decide that it's too dangerous, we're going to walk off. And this is the thing that I think is also in the backdrop negotiations now is, I don't think if in 3 weeks or 2 weeks now, I guess, there's a government shutdown, I don't think we wait 40 days for labor action. I think it happens on day two. I mean, and on some level, I mean, people have been through a lot of grief, and there's still, if you're a contractor, you haven't gotten paid back. But it would be interesting to see that happen.
I think you,
because it's
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No,
I was going to say you're spot on there. You know, it's contagious, and we've seen this steady buildup of labor action over the last, particularly since Donald Trump was elected. And, you know, if it's a side effect of his election, that's fine. You know, we can calculate that into our calculus, right? But I think in general, the taste and the experience that these teacher unions are having and the different unions across the country are having, it is beyond contagious. They are most certainly going to act right away, because they are going to question themselves, like, why would we continue to put our financial stability at risk, along with the safety and security of the United States, of people flying, for example, put them at risk when we have this power that we just flexed. So, yeah, they're going to have to flex it again. But I think it's so politically toxic at this point that if Donald Trump takes it back there again, I'd be surprised. You know, he's Donald Trump, and maybe I shouldn't say it, but I think maybe he is smart enough to realize that this is going to be entirely too toxic for a round two this quickly.
It's going to be interesting, though. I think he's going to announce a national emergency, but I think he's also going to have real problems doing that from, the Freedom Caucus. So he's really in a bind here because he, I think, pathologically believes that if he doesn't deliver not even the actual wall, but the illusion of a wall, that somehow his people will desert him. Although, and maybe that's a good way to segue, he has that, I think, that belief. It's going to be interesting, because I think at the State of the Union on Tuesday night, he's going to try his plan B. And I think it's going to be around abortion. They're going to take advantage of what of Virginia and New York State passing laws that remove any obstacles to the late term abortions, or not any obstacles, I should say, but any potential obstacles coming from the federal government. And I think they're going to use that, because at the end of the day, one of the big reasons why Donald Trump is in office is because Merrick Garland's seat was open. And evangelicals don't need to believe that this guy is a saint. They just need to believe that he's going to deliver what he says he's going to deliver. And he did that.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that is the one promise that he doesn't get, I think, enough credit for, which is he said he was just going to take the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society's list and just the worst of the worst, I'm going to put him on the Supreme Court. And he did it.
Yeah. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And if you notice, have you noticed like a really subtle shift, and not too subtle, actually, all the language and the jargon about God appointing him and his references to the Bible, Sarah Huckabee Sanders coming out, you know, they are most certainly making this pivot to appeal to the evangelical base, which is not too, you know, if you look at the Venn diagram, there's quite a bit of an overlap between their evangelical base and the white supremacist base. It might be a one for one, but I digress. The point is that where they can't win on the wall issue, you always know, and this isn't just Donald Trump. George W. Bush did it. George H.W. Bush did it. Ronald Reagan started the entire process with the with this marriage with evangelicals. But they know all they have to do is peddle to their moral values, because quote unquote moral values, and they can push their voters, their base, back to the polls.
Yeah, and I don't even think it's like the they're appealing to their moral values. I think it's a material. They are delivering a material benefit, which to them is the judiciary. And they have largely certainly done it in a way that has been more effective than we've seen in the past. Right. I mean, the federal judiciary is dramatically different today than it would have even under like Marco Rubio.
Right. Right. Exactly. No, and you're absolutely right. So he has delivered. Like I wrote a book some years ago about religion and politics. And one of the things that was so easy to kind of smack evangelicals around the face with was the fact that none of these presidents had delivered anything for them. You know, up to George W. Bush, there was nothing. You know, he had the opportunity. He had the space. He had the time. He had the political capital to do something. And he really didn't. And well, now I have to kind of revise the entire book now, because Donald Trump has delivered what they needed in terms of the Supreme Court and the judiciary all across the board, which you know, I'm not sure if you're ready to pivot. But when you think about the number of appointments he has had, that just really sobers me up in terms of the conversations about our primary fights, the everything, you know, 2016, relitigating 2016. Like, we have a real we have a problem ahead of us for an entire generation, and it can continue to get worse.
There are two things that people should look out for. Well, two specific things, but then one more broader. Trump's talking about abortion, you know, because we haven't had a conversation about abortion, you know, it seems to me, in the national news for at least a couple of years.
Right, for sure.
Outside of the ones that he probably paid for.
Yeah.
Trump's going to talk about abortion in the State of the Union, and they're going to make a big deal if Ginsburg is not there, and she won't be, because she skipped it in 2018, and there's no reason to expect that she's going to go now unless she wants to show that specifically, like, I'm healthy enough to show up there. But that is going to be... And then overall, there's going to be more of this God Squad talk. I think you're right.
Yeah.
And all of that is going to be, this could be his plan B, right? Like, I may not have the wall, but if I can make something else big enough, maybe my rubes will not remember the wall. I personally don't think they care. I think as long as the rhetoric is there, they're going to feel good about it.
Yeah.
But...
You know, he has the Ann Coulters and the Rush Limbaughs on his back. But, you know, I think at some point he's going to make the call that, you know, he may just have to lose an Ann Coulter. She might end up being an enemy of his.
She'll be back.
Pivoting. She'll be back. Exactly.
She'll be
pivoting back to this conversation would bring her back. And even if she didn't come back, it would put her at odds with all of the evangelicals in their base. So she'll be forced back into his loving arms.
I'm quite, you know, even it just occurs to me, like, even Dave Rubin now is talking about, like, I may have to be anti-choice because of the video clip I saw from Virginia. It's an interesting way to sort of establish. It's
maybe
an interesting way to develop.
Maybe a white nation state.
But I also think that, look, they talk, I would imagine, in ways that, you know, that we talk, and certainly, like, I've had conversations in the past where I'm like, what do you think is going to be on the horizon? Antitrust. Mm-hmm. All right, yeah, I'm going to dig into that. I imagine that they have those conversations too. It's just more like, it's just a little thinner. And and I wouldn't be surprised if there was a sense of, like, we're going to be talking more about abortion because we need to go somewhere. And we need to make it about, we need to, like, set, you know, we need to say something that triggers the Supreme, you got to vote because of the Supreme Court thing. And it's true. They do. We do, too.
I mean, the counterbalance to that, obviously, the countervailing force would be people finally realizing on the left that, you know, as bad as any of our candidates will be, we have to vote also, right? I mean, we're already in a precarious situation that if the right case got to the Supreme Court, I mean, the numbers are in the favor of overturning Roe versus Wade. You know, it really depends on the Chief Justice. But
you don't even need to do that today.
Exactly.
As we sit here, the Supreme Court is debating. I don't know if they're actually debating. I'm not exactly sure how that works, but they have been asked by some lawyers in and abortion providers in Louisiana to respond to a case that went through the Fifth Circuit. This is the Gee versus what's the name of that case? Well. Nevertheless, it's a Louisiana case. What is it? June Medical Services versus Gee. And this is a trap law identical to the one out of Texas 3 years ago in the Hellerstedt case. Mm-hmm. And or Whole Woman's Health, I guess they call it. And the Supreme Court at that time, as constructed at that time, after Scalia had appreciately left us, very, very, very considerately left us at a very nice time. They 5-3, Kennedy voted mm-hmm. with the liberals on the court, and that trap law, which infringed upon a woman's right to an abortion, was rejected. This is the exact same law.
Right.
If the Supreme Court decides not to take up this case, which has been, in my mind, purposefully mishandled by the Fifth Circuit, right? They've gone directly against Supreme Court precedent. Then that is the law of the land within the region that is governed by the
yes.
Fifth Circuit. And then we're going
right.
to see that in about 3 or 4 other circuits around the country. And it could be a matter of, you know, months, maybe a year, when the Republican legislatures pass these laws and abortion will be effectively outlawed in
yeah.
half a dozen states. And so, you know, we don't even need to see Roe v. Wade overturned directly for this type of outcome. I mean, we've seen hints of this, but this would be on a bigger scale.
Right, right. And I mean, and this speaks to the longevity. Dropped my phone there for a second. The longevity of our problems that we're facing. I mean, Trump, the last I checked, I think I checked earlier this week, 85 appointments, including 2 to the Supreme Court. I mean, these are lifetime appointments. And, you know, what is our strategy to recuperate from this as progressives, as people on the left? I get the feeling that we're still, you know, the taste in our mouth, the taste of blood from the 2016 primaries is still in our mouths. And I think we really rather focus on that fight, I guess, as a way of coping or distracting ourselves away from what's really ahead of us over the next generation.
Yeah. Well, it's easier, right?
Yeah.
Well, and that's a good
sell out.
Yeah, exactly. Enjoy your neoliberal whatever the
neoliberal shill sell out.
Exactly.
Speaking of which, let's play Cory Booker's video. It's a well done video. Like, I like the, it starts with a drummer.
Universal Love, huh?
Yeah. Let's just play a little bit of like the I can't watch the whole thing again, but let's
some
play
of us haven't
a
watched
little
this
bit.
Yet, Sam. Can we do the whole
have
thing?
Have you not?
I have not. This is all I wanted to wait to have a real live reaction to it.
All right, we're just going to play
man,
the
I'm
first,
already nauseous.
We'll point. Play the first 20. I'll tell you what. We'll play the first 20 seconds and then the last 20 seconds, and then maybe we'll play more of it when Virgil sits down with us. But here it is. One drum.
In America, we have a common pain, but what we're lacking is a sense of common purpose.
Fuck yeah.
What's up? Amen.
I grew up knowing that the only way we can make change is when people come together. When I was a baby, my parents tried to move us into a neighborhood with great public schools, but realtors wouldn't sell us a home because of the color of our skin. A group of white lawyers who had watched the courage of civil rights activists were inspired to help black families in their own community, including mine. And they changed the course of my entire life. Because in America, courage is contagious. My dad told me, boy,
pause
never
for one
forget
second.
Where you
now,
came
so we're
from
left
how
hanging.
Many people
I don't
had
know
to sac-
I don't know Cory Booker's story enough to know what those white lawyers did.
Yeah.
They helped his family move into a suburb.
Oh, did they do that?
And I believe that's the story. It's a cheap shot, maybe, but like, where's a picture of him with Shmuley Boteik when he's talking about like housing discrimination? It's like no housing discrimination here, but home bulldozing there.
It's a little bit early to roll that out in your intro.
No, I'm take always makes an early appearance.
But let's go now. Fast forward to the last 20 seconds, because that's when the music really starts to swell. There's more drummers now, and go ahead.
There's more drummers.
Instead of shuffling more children into cages and coffins, where we see the faces of our leaders on television and feel pride, not shame. It is not a matter of can we. It's a matter of do we have the collective will, the American will. I believe we do. Together, we will channel our common pain back into our common purpose. Together, America, we will rise.
So
I'm Cory Booker, and I'm running for president of the United States of America.
Yeah, we know.
Part of it is like, look, I have spent a decent amount over the past 25 years doing voiceovers and in one form or another. And I can't help but see him in the studio when he's hitting every point. And the poetry slam that he went to get the cadence like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And I am Sam Cedar saying that. And now, but most people won't have that problem. And I know that's sort of petty response to it. But
yeah.
Kamala Harris had her big speech, 20,000 people. That's pretty impressive. Booker has this. It shows some polish. But both of these two candidates are running on sort of like pretty general stuff. Now, Kamala Harris followed it up with a town hall on CNN where she came out very forcefully for Medicare for All. And then the next day, sort of.
Not so much.
A
little less forceful.
And so I don't know. What's your sense?
Okay. So this is my line throughout the entire primaries. I don't like anybody. all of them are going to have as much as I like Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders, if he runs, which we all assume he is, he's got some issues that I just do not like about him. But he just came out against BDS unnecessarily. So he could have made his point without even prefacing it with that. He has a couple of blind spots. But I only bring that up to say that I don't like any of them. But whoever wins this primary, I'm going to love that person, put on their T-shirt. I'm going to go door to door. You can call me a neoliberal shill. You can thank me later when we're not hemorrhaging even more judicial appointments and even more Supreme Court picks. So, I can easily jump on board with how much I really, really dislike Cory Booker. I think I got a video out there called Cory Booker is trash. Feel free to go give me some clicks because I explain in great detail how inauthentic he is, right? Phony. But man, I will eat my socks and my words. If he gets this nomination, I'm going to put on a Cory Booker T-shirt and I'm going to go door to door and I'm going to talk with the same cadence and tenor. It might, and say, you need to go. It's almost like a Jim Kirk. You're like, you really need to go vote for Cory Booker. But that's my take, man. I'm not in love with any of these candidates. And I think it's important for us realistically to not approach this like one of them is our boyfriend or a girlfriend. Like, we don't have to defend their honor. We just need to, let's fight out these primaries, see who has the best policies. Realistically, who has the best ground game, because that's what's going to matter the most. And then when it's all said and done, let's get this madman out of the White House.
I've been in a committed relationship with Bernie since 2016, but do you think though, when you look at this video, just like he's not as good in my estimation a performer as Kamala Harris, and he's also doing what Obama did it better, to be blunt.
He's so running for vice president.
Okay, that's I want to see what the logic is.
There is half of the people. We'll get to more of this.
I found it very revealing because insofar as the only actual policy thing or the only specific thing he talked about in there is my family, we had the money to buy a house, but they wouldn't sell it to us because of the color of our skin. And that's a problem that he can help you with. If you don't have the money to buy a house He's probably out of ideas. And that's what it means to be a neoliberal.
I mean, to be fair, he did expand affordable housing in Newark. Now, there was also a lot of things that he did that were not particularly good that he did in Newark. But fortunately for him, Newark remains an incredibly poor and sort of debilitated city.
But governed now by a progressive education activist who ran explicitly on repudiating all of Booker's work
And fortunately for Booker, when he came on the scene there, it was a disaster. Like about as disastrous as it could be, but yeah, I think your perspective on this is an interesting one. I guess I have one question for you in terms of Kamala Harris, which this came up. It seems to me that there's going to be an opportunity for candidates like her to avoid dealing with going too deep into the specifics of policies. Like, look, she came out and was forceful in saying no private insurers and then had to back off that a day later. That to me suggests that her relationship to that issue was not necessarily as deep as she wanted to communicate.
Oh yeah.
And,
yeah, for sure.
And, but I think when you have 20 people in a race, you can maintain that. Like you can hide quite a bit.
Yeah.
And the one area where I think that she is not going to be able to hide, and I'm curious as to your perspective on this, is her
record.
Her record as a prosecutor. And I am not against all prosecutors. I think you could be a very good prosecutor and healthy. Like I was hoping Zephyr Teachout would be one.
Mm-hmm.
But the question to me is, in my mind, is will the Black Lives Matter folks who are best situated to address this at least first, right, with Kamala Harris, the people who have worked in criminal justice reform, across the board, they are best situated to address this first to Kamala Harris. My question is, are they going to do it?
Yeah, it really depends. So I mean, if I'm going to answer this question honestly, it might open up a can of worms here. So the honest answer is they probably will and more than happily do it because of her clear and abysmal record, targeting truancy and with policies that disproportionately affect people of color because they disproportionately affect impoverished communities. And so it's really a slam dunk and it's already happening. Right. So let's be clear. Like there are plenty of voices who are not like officially affiliated with Black Lives Matter, who are speaking out because of just their personal opinion with regard to Kamala and her track record. And more importantly, her attempt to spin herself to be a progressive prosecutor, which she was not. So it's already happening. It's going to continue to happen. But where it gets complicated is if there is this expectation that they have to do it, for one, because then they'll, realistically, they'll be like, well, no, I don't have to do it. You know, if I feel like doing it, I will. And is that petty? Yeah, but it's also a dynamic that you have to keep in mind. Like, if the expectation is for Black Lives Matter to save you all from Kamala Harris, then that's not gonna resonate really well with us. Mm-hmm. And I just use that kind of like categorically. I'm not even affiliated with Black Lives Matter to be sure. But keep that in mind that people are doing it individually. But everybody pitch in, and if you really dislike Kamala as much as you probably should, let's just keep putting. Keep repeating her videos over and over again. I think they speak for themselves.
Yeah, I think so. And I think once that wall is breached, right? Once she is put on the defensive for her record as a prosecutor, then you're going to start to see the people who are coming in saying like, and here's who you didn't prosecute. Right.
Yeah.
Because that's going to open up a whole nother group of folks, because if she gets lumped in with Booker as a friend of big finance, is going to set up. That's ultimately going to be the dividing line. But We shall see, and we're going to talk more about this with Virgil Texas in a minute. But, Ben, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, man, we didn't get to slam dunk on Howard Schultz. But
I'm willing to do that, too.
No, we don't have to. We can, okay.
No, let him get a hack at Howard Schultz.
Yeah, please.
That's almost like being rude to a guest.
I agree.
It's like, well, you know, I think I've done it. Like, just by being able to bring it up, Sam, I really appreciate it. If there's anybody in this race that I honestly would fight tooth and nail and scorch the earth with, it's got to be the guy who's willing to invest billions of dollars of his own money to make sure that we understand that we don't deserve Medicare for all. Like, that's the guy. Like, out of all the people, all the things wrong with the Kamala, all the things wrong with Booker and him being so inauthentic, with everything wrong with all of our candidates, Howard Schultz is a unifying force. And I really simultaneously appreciate him and hate the fact that he's running, because I think he is the guy who's going to unify us all around. Like, we might have some crappy Democrats, but this guy, he has a vested interest in making sure that we understand we don't deserve anything better. So, you know, not a lot of slam dunking.
You like Bill Burton, though, right?
You got to give Bill Burton credit.
You
got to give Schultz credit, because he's clearly thought about this stuff. And feel really strongly deeply about it. Like, there's an authenticity to his oligarchic perspective that I think is sincere.
Did you see? I didn't even see.
He definitely thinks that we're the little people.
Did you see Trump's greeting him in the race? And I guess in one of Schultz's interviews, he did when he's like, "Look, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but like, I know who to put in the room or whatever." And Trump immediately hits. He's like, "He doesn't have the guts," and he says it himself. Not the smartest guy in the room. He just went right at the beautiful angle.
You know what's a crazy juxtaposition, though? What's really crazy is, like, all the way you set it up, which is perfect, Sam, how Kamala Harris and Cory Booker are, like, really friends of the financier establishment. Well, if you think that is bad, here we have a guy directly from, like, the uber 1%, right? Who's showing us that as bad as a Kamala Harris is all around the board, like, this guy and what he stands for really is representative of the donor class of the Democratic Party. Like, if you really want to get down to the brass tacks of it, he is the donor class of the Democratic Party, and they are coming out kicking and screaming because they hate the possibility of an AOC in a couple of years. So these are the people that Cory Booker answers to.
This is the interesting thing about it. On one hand, he makes them look a little better. On the other hand, Warren and Sanders and maybe someone like Sherrod Brown, if these people are smart in this race, he will end up being the club that they smack them with.
Like, oh, yeah.
We're going to be hearing about Howard Schultz Democrats or Howard Schultz types. Like, he's going to be an icon, hopefully.
Howard Schultz Democrats like sell out Ben Dixon.
Exactly. Ben,
exactly.
Go back and enjoy your whatever you neoliberals do on a Friday.
Hey, man. We're counting our George Soros money. So.
Tell George Soros I said hi. Thanks. I appreciate it. Ben, the Benjamin Dixon Show. Also, check out thenorthstar.com. Folks, going to take a very quick break. And then when we come back, Virgil Texas will be here from Chapo Trap House in studio. And Matt, do we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song or anything like that? Wow, everybody just shook their heads in a weird way.
We have guests.
Okay, all right, I'm sorry, we have guests. I shouldn't have raised that. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back in a sec.
Like some leaf coming in the window of a restroom. I couldn't tell you what the hell it was about.
I mean, if you want to hear. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure. Welcome back to the Majority Report studio, Virgil, Texas, from a show called Chapo Trap House, which I think people are familiar with. Also, one of the co-authors of, what's the name of your book?
Well, I'm glad you asked. The Chapo Guide to Revolution, A Manifesto Against Logic, Facts, and Reason.
And that was a New York Times bestseller.
A New York Times bestseller, yeah.
That's very exciting. And so, you didn't even bring a copy of this.
I did. I thought it would be gauche if I were waving it around, but I can if you want.
No, I just thought you would be gauche. I didn't realize that.
If I were going to be gauche, this is the place to do it, isn't
this
it?
This is gauche.
We actually
central.
Were complimenting you on your impeccable, relentless self-promotion skills the last time you were on. We respect the hustle here.
Oh, definitely. Now
that's a big compliment coming from Michael.
That's exactly right. There is no facetiousness whatsoever in that.
I'm gonna. Oh shoot!
Yeah,
oh,
your board. Your board doesn't.
He's my board up.
That was for Jamie.
That was a compliment from Jamie. Not
from me. All right, so Virgil, let's start with this. I know you mentioned you're a bit of a Schultz head.
Yeah. I've got all his books.
And how many books does Howard Schultz have?
I think the one that just came out is the third one because really? When we went on our West Coast tour last year, we did a couple shows in Seattle. And so, you know, we had to read the two Howard Schultz books and roast them. And we just put out a bonus episode a few days ago with live cuts from that live show.
He really has three books?
I think so, yes.
Were the first two also coffee puns?
Oh, God, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I'm going to say yes.
Was it one top it off or, you know.
Higher ground.
That's
ooh,
good.
Ooh, that's great.
No, the first one is Onward, How Starbucks Fought for Its Life Without Losing Its Purpose.
He also wrote Pour Your Heart Into It.
There you go.
Your heart into it.
Was Pour Your Heart Into It the second book?
That was the second one.
No, that was really? 1997.
So oh my wait God. A second. So he left.
He also has one From the Ground Up.
Well, that's the new one.
That's very the one close. That just came out.
That's a new one. But so his middle book, he left. He sort of eschewed the pun for the middle one, and then came back to it when he realized like that maybe it wasn't a success.
He also edited co-wrote for Love of Country. What our veterans can teach us about citizenship, heroism.
We should try to think of a coffee pun for a book about veterans.
Veterans,
yeah.
Don't die on a hill of beans.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Thank you for your service, but no use crying over
boots on the ground.
There you go, boots
good.
On the ground. Yeah. Jeff.
Works. All right. Well, so you're a Schultz head. I don't know if you've seen. You know his two top, I guess, advisors. Steve Schmidt and Bill Burton.
He hired them.
Yeah.
They're on contract with him.
So you don't think they're working pro bono?
Oh, no, I'm asking. I'm asking how long that arrangement's been going on.
That is a good question. Now, Steve Schmidt has left MSNBC as a contributor.
That check must be so good.
I don't know that his check from MSNBC was that massive.
You think I'm talking about the MSNBC
no,
check?
No, no. Yeah, the yeah. check must be really good yeah. that he's getting. I mean, yeah. they must be getting an enormous amount of money.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is you hire Steve Schmidt, who is a political consultant, if you're going to go join the political arena, if you're going to run for an office, you wouldn't just hire him to be your friend.
Right.
Your regular consultant. Though after reading Schultz's two books, that's sort of the stupid sort of fucking thing he might do.
Well, I think he's still.
I lost the campaign.
So,
but
do
I
you think that
friend.
He's committed to running at this point?
He would do a thing that's like, you know, we're going to run this coffee shop like a political campaign,
right? Or we're going to solve the race issue in America through suggesting that you bother your barista with a question about race while they're preparing your latte, which was a thing a year ago.
Well, did you think, let me ask you this. Do you think that he has made a determination to run at this point? Or do you think he's still in that mode of like, I'll see, there's certain, I need to see a certain poll number before I declare?
I don't know, because my honest instinct is that he's selling a book. I mean, that's what he is. He's on a book tour right now, and this kind of thing gins up sales. But people also said the same thing about Trump when he ran in 2015.
Right. And but you just made the point, too. Do you hire Bill Burton and Steve Schmidt if you're doing a book? Like,
That's why I'm curious about the nature of their employment.
Well, it's enough that Steve Schmidt had to quit MSNBC, and I know that, you know, every now and then I get an email from, in fact, I just got one like yesterday. Maybe this was a function of it. I don't know, because it seemed, but it's, I got one that is from, what is it called? The MSNBC trust thing or something like that, basically saying, make sure you tell us if you're getting paid by someone on the outside is essentially what the email said.
Yeah, I know. I tell MSNBC all the time whenever I get money from another source.
There you go. Yeah, I'm sure. We all do, right? Right? Well, here is Steve Schmidt on Nicole Wallace.
Nicole Wallace is interesting in this clip.
And just in fairness to the critics of an independent run, the 2016 election was decided by a razor-thin margin, and the third-party candidates could have done just what they're afraid they did, siphoned off enough votes to tip the election.
Well, let's look at what Howard Schultz has said that has set off this frenzy. He said that, "I'm seriously considering running for president. It's the right of every American."
Hold on, pause it for one second, and I want to go back. But Steve Schmidt, he's getting so much money that he feels completely comfortable, like totally dressing down now. Did you notice that? Like every time he's been on MSNBC, yes, for the he's worn a tie, and now he's going out there like I've got to hit.
I feel like he was the type of guy who would go on Bill Maher and wear some type of poor fitted
suit. That to me is a sign of how much money he's making off of this.
That has set off this frenzy. He said that, "I'm seriously considering running for president. It's the right of every American, should they choose to do so. And if I do so, I'll do it as a centrist independent candidate." He also has said he will not be a spoiler in the race. He has also said he views it as an urgent national imperative to remove this morally unfit president from office. He believes that. He's not Jill Stein. He's not Ross Perot. He's not Ralph Nader. What he said is he wants to have a conversation with the American people to see if perhaps the hour of disruption may be at hand for our utterly broken political system. And make no mistake about it, the brokenness of that political system is what resulted in the election of Donald John Trump.
Pause it for one second. Wasn't Trump that thing?
Precisely.
Wasn't Trump the victory the disruption of the political moment or
it
whatever?
Was disruptive,
it was?
Yeah.
I'll say that. And many respects, innovative.
And it reflected the actual center more, which is socially more to the right and economically populist if you pull it.
But he wants to say that the disruption was the victory of Trump, who was the, as opposed to the disruption that allowed Trump to, okay.
Election of Donald John Trump. Are we fated in perpetuity to be in this cycle of revenge politics, of self-interest, where the American people are not represented, their future is not represented, or can we do something better? And so 600 days before the election, he's asked a question. And so we decry rightly the illiberalism of Donald Trump, his attacks on the press, his attacks on the rule of law. But what about the illiberalism of people who claim to oppose Trump, who shout down people from the public square? It seems that for some, the progressive utopia that is on the horizon is one that will not come about by persuasion, but by imposition, because you better dare not speak out of line, out of turn, no deviation, or you are shouted down. And by the way, the people who are doing the shouting almost universally are the same people who said,
all right, pause. I want to go back.
He's some asshole. He's just some asshole. Who the fuck are you to show up and say, I'm just asking the question of should I run for president? I don't care. I don't have to answer that. No.
But it's also sort of the idea that this guy's been shouted off the national stage. There, if you were to take the total sum of the airtime or the public exposure that 99% of the country who are even remotely interested in the idea of politics and somehow quantify that, he would have blown that figure away in the first 24 hours that he decided he's thinking about running.
This is the IDW principle.
Exactly.
If you criticize me, that is the suppression. The deplatforming is any response to anything I've said that's negative on all of the endless platforms I've been given. So, I mean, and what's also funny is, like, the person who literally shouted him down was a citizen who went to Barnes & Noble in Union Square to beg this asshole to not help get Trump get reelected.
But here is the best part of this, it seems to me. Who they're villainizing, and this is what I find like even the most despicable thing that they're doing, because we now know from a story, I guess it was in Politico or Washington Post, that the advisors have admitted, well, what we realize we really have to do is knock whoever the Democratic candidate is out of the box and make Howard I can't even say it without laughing. Howard Schultz more palatable to 51% of the country than any Democratic candidate. But look at they're getting a little scorched earthy here, or at least attempting to, by who they're blaming. They're like, listen to this.
Those Trump who shout down people from the public square. It seems that for some, the progressive utopia that is on the horizon is one that will not come about by persuasion, but by imposition, because you better dare not speak out of line, out of turn, no deviation, or you are shouted down. And by the way, the people who are doing the shouting almost universally are the same people who said Joe Biden shouldn't run because it was Hillary Clinton's turn. And they're the same people who put their thumb on the scale for Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders because he couldn't win. And they guaranteed us that Donald Trump would never be elected.
You're on TV. You can't complain about being shouted down when you are shouting at me from television.
But can you believe that he's bringing up the rigging? That Bernie was rigged
generalized bullshit pseudo-populism, so it makes it actually even more like Trump. So right now we have, I'm a billionaire who knows nothing, and you should vote for me because I'm rich and we live in it's capitalism, so I'll just do stuff good.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it is and then there's this generalized thing that you should never concentrate on anything to do with the economic elites, obviously, or the actual system that's screwing you. But there is this sort of broad riggedness that I'm opposed to. Vote for me now.
Well, but they're going.
That literally is the same. That he's is
specifically
Trump
saying
the flair.
It was
that's
the
amazing.
Clinton people who delivered Trump. I mean, it's fascinating that he's. Those are the people that he's isolating.
It's like anti-corruption
politics,
though.
It
can float everywhere if you don't hook it to an analysis.
But it's almost like either Steve Schmidt is purposely tanking it, or they're that deluded where they think like the Sanders folk are going to be the ones who turn, you know, who
or they don't
who gather around
because.
Yeah, right. I think it's safe to say they really don't care.
Yeah.
This is impressive because they could be making both Burton and Schmidt could have made like fuck you money with this, right? Like
so
we're signing a pay or play contract. You can fire us in a month, but you got to pay us for the next 12 months, and it's a million each or something. And for him, I'd buy that.
I'm just picturing meetings where Burton and Schmidt are like looking at their iPhones, like. Coordinating like babysitting plans or something, and occasionally looking up to be like, bring America back. Yup, that's exactly it.
It's a moment of disruption.
Innovation.
What was Burton's line?
I can't remember Burton's line.
You need to risk the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
That's actually how they opened the Chapo book.
It really is a win-win for these ghouls, right? Because if Trump wins again, they're not going to be the ones who suffer. They're actually going to be better off financially under Trump than under a left-wing president like Bernie. And if he doesn't win, they'll still pocket all the money. So good for them.
But ultimately, I think we're all kind of everyone's been hyperventilating about this Schultz thing and exaggerating the actual impact of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to use this as an opportunity, like AOC did, to point out the basic inequality in society, that just because you're very, very wealthy, you get to change the discussion and you get to have everyone talk about you being president, and you just seem like someone who could be president as opposed to, say, one of the baristas who works in one of his coffee shops. But the election is 21 months away. The filing deadlines are like 16 months away. I mean, there could be five other adventurous billionaires running for office. I'm sure a lot of them are thinking about it. I know for at least several years now, people have been talking about like Mark Cuban or The Rock or something, or one of these silly season.
Cuban should shake on Trump in a Republican primary. The country needs it. Yeah. Go do it, Mark.
Yeah,
and they'll spend a lot of money on that.
And the thing is, everyone is obsessed and nauseated by the Schultz thing because they are that is just the lingering anxiety from 2016 of a spoiler, you know, preventing a Democratic victory, allowing Trump to be elected on a national scale, which says to me that, okay, these people just didn't internalize the lessons of 2016, or they don't have a heuristic to explain why that happened. So they're still just kind of, you know, that tank is pretty much empty and they're just making shit up at this point.
I do think that there is value to someone like maybe a Warren and certainly a Sanders in making the idea of a third party billionaire candidate super, super toxic right now, right? Because now it is making it generically toxic, as opposed to the greater than zero chance that if Bernie Sanders, as opposed to really any other possible Democratic nominee, is the nominee, that a Howard Schultz comes in. And there is enough people in the Democratic Party who are, you know, scared of a socialist, and you know, you get Bill Kristol and Anna Navarro, and then all of a sudden you think maybe we could win a couple of states.
He's a very classic guy.
I mean, I don't. I mean, again, this is all so far away, so this is all playing fantasy football. But I would rather. I mean, I don't really care that much about Schultz's presidential ambitions. I would rather he, as a person with his position in society, just not exist.
Right.
Being a bill should be abolished. Being the Starbucks CEO should freaking be abolished.
Having the name Howard should probably.
If that's where the discussion goes, then I would say that's a productive discussion. If this leads to, you know, millions of people questioning who is this asshole and why does he want to be
frankly,
our king now?
Right. And frankly, if he decides to run, and I think I agree. I mean, the only chance he will actually do it is if Sanders or Warren or potentially Sherrod Brown is the nominee. And if he decides to run, I think he'll spend an unbelievable amount of money. And I think, look, I don't want to put another variable in the race. I want Trump out of there, but I think he'll get. I think you could do a very fun graph where you compare the amount of spending he spends to the amount Jill Stein spent, and then their national vote basically coming to about the same total. He's going to have no resonance with the broader public. This grid of far-right economics and sort of not even liberalism, just like basic social tolerance, is only popular in the Morning Joe green room. So, and if he does run, and in that scenario, it will solidify the lesson Virgil's talking about, which is like these people are a menace.
The other thing
and
is
fundamentally narcissistic.
The other thing is, yeah, he only plays in green rooms and op-ed pages. And I've seen just so much blather in the past few days of people saying, you know, well, thank you, Howard Schultz, for injecting ideas into this discussion, you know, because we've had about all this crazy, crazy pie in the sky shit about a Green New Deal and Medicare for all. And thanks for giving us serious stuff. And it's like, what's a single policy or idea you've heard from Howard Schultz?
Wait, who said that?
He's going to disrupt the possibility of imagination.
Yeah, it's all I see it. I swear. I seen it with my own two eyes. Somebody's saying that.
Okay, so this just fits in some idiot
some
on
dunces,
Twitter.
Some dunce is saying that.
Okay, yeah. Well,
we're all going to get him. We're all going to harass the hell out of him.
Oh, wait,
we're gonna, we are going to make him afraid.
I think we found the dunce. Here is a this is a clip from
a mirror behind me.
No, well, it's right here too.
Oh, good.
It's you can look over here as well.
Dunce can be from
the now who is Mike Slater? Do we know who this guy is?
He's a Fox Radio host.
Okay, and he's on the he is a Fox Radio from the oh the course the Mike Slater show.
I would call him
TMSS.
He is
TMSS.
He is on What is this? The outnumbered? Yeah, this is the, well, let's see what they're saying on Fox.
Sci-fi writer Robert Heinlein said the natural state of man is poverty. And it's only for the makers, not the moochers, the makers like Mr. Howard Schultz, that we have jobs, that we have industries, that we have growth, that we have prosperity. And when you start attacking those people, then you're going to fall back into a state of poverty, as Kat was talking about, as we see in Venezuela.
Pause it. I love the fact...
Was he saying Venezuela?
I love the fact that you have to cite a sci-fi writer.
And that's the other thing about Schultz's utter lack of appeal is because, yeah, he can pay for these expensive consultants who are going to tell him to run a campaign like the losing campaigns that they've run in the past. It says, you just want to say some bullshit about, rolling up your sleeves, that kind of crap. And the vast majority of people at this point know that they're being bullshitted. Everyone bullshits them. And if you're the kind of person who thinks, oh, gosh, roll up your sleeves, that's a great message, your vote's pretty much irrelevant at that point anyway.
Right.
No one is actively alienating you because you can't be alienated because you don't actually have political views.
So, all right, so give me
I think this whole Venezuela, I'm not suggesting that most Americans are, excited about defending the Bolivarian Revolution, but I think that, you always talk about how, Chicago politics, what does that mean? I get that people generally probably think oh, that's a bad situation in Venezuela. But I think that the average person and voter is very able to distinguish between a country in Latin America that they know they don't understand versus Bernie Sanders, AOC are on television saying that rich people shouldn't be able to just bequeath their kids castles. When we don't have health care.
I don't think that the vast majority of the American population knows where Venezuela is, frankly. But I think if they're setting the table that if there's – I mean, this is what the right does, I think, very well. They plant a lot of flowers, and they see what's going to bloom. Mm-hmm. And if we start having images on our TV of riots in Venezuela, it doesn't even really matter what they are.
Right.
The idea that they have built this sort of association with AOC and Bernie with Venezuela is going to pay some dividends for them, even if people have no idea what any of it means.
Mm.
I think.
Can we go back to that ridiculous tweet for a second where he says the natural state of man is poverty and the only reason anyone has any money is because billionaires gave it to them? How ahistorical is that?
Well, everything ahistorical. The idea that if it were not for billionaires, we would not have food is just absurd.
How does he think things are produced? And how does he think things were produced before capitalism?
He's a...
They weren't.
He's a sci-fi writer. Maybe in the future. That's what he's saying. Well, this is a warning.
Well, Jamie, you're right. That's their line because that's a thing that I hear a lot of dumb people say. That's a dumb guy thing to say. You don't like this billionaire. Well, how do you have a job? And I think that's, part of it is just that's how we've been raised and socialized in this country to think in those rigid terms. We don't think about the actual components of wealth and the actual position of labor in society is creating wealth.
And the critique of that is the anxiety that's driving Howard Schultz to run for president. There's the narcissism, but there's also the primal anxiety of some of these things being called into question.
Yeah,
and those guys freaking out at Davos.
So when you see the media class, put up guys like Schultz and increasingly Mike Bloomberg, who's planning to run for president, and frequently being quoted as attacking Liz Warren or Bernie Sanders or AOC, I think that's like you said, we're going to put some stuff up and see what hits. And maybe these billionaires, these deeply uncharismatic, bullshitting billionaires who are just lecturing you will convince people to tamp down on their populist urges.
I mean, if I'm Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, I think I am pretty psyched about maybe these guys getting in the Democratic primary, even just being on the scene. It is now I don't have to sort of talk theoretically or, conceptually. I can just say look at that guy.
Look at him. He's 5'5" and he's screeching at you in this reedy voice about big gulps.
Exactly.
Yeah. I won't pay taxes, but you can't drink a soda.
But here's the thing. I think that guys like Bloomberg joining the race and expanding the rightward bound of the field also benefits people like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and helps them kind of escape some of the criticism they're going to be receiving from the left.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Here is, let's put this, this is a pretty funny tweet by Amy Klobuchar.
Oh, this is wonderful.
This is so,
you know, I'm a member of the DSA, and this is, we're talking about endorsing this as our next big platform.
this is Senator Amy Klobuchar, who is supposedly contemplating jumping into the race, and
I don't think so.
The American workforce is changing, and there isn't one path to success. I've introduced bipartisan legislation. That could go so many different, like when you say the American workforce is changing and there isn't one path to success, like it could be opening up. And that's why I am introducing a plan to support people who want to work in non-commercial endeavors. And we're going to provide stipends for people who are doing social services and teaching. No, that's not where it goes.
So I tried to understand this. I consider myself a relatively intelligent person. And here's my guess, just from reading this. You know, I don't know what that
is. We haven't even finished the whole thing yet.
Oh, yeah. God, I thought you did.
No, sorry. Oh, I've introduced bipartisan legislation with Senator Sass, that's Ben Sass, to allow people to use tax advantage savings accounts to pay for educational expenses like skills training, apprenticeships, and professional development. In other words, we're going to do 529s, and instead of just paying for college and private school now, you can also use that for stuff that may not be accredited,
Skillshare,
like for-profit universities or other places like that. So we're going to deny funds to the U.S. government and put it in the hands of people who, you know, may be scrupulous, but probably not.
As well, the people who have that brewing point in the South, the people who actually do need skills training and professional development, things like that, don't have the means to
save money.
They don't have the means to pay for it, and would not have had the means to save for it. Like, would I be using this account? I don't know. I mean, but podcasting, you know, gets obsoleted at some point, and, you know, it's replaced with AI or those Korean mukbang videos or whatever. And I need a new job, but I don't think I'd take advantage of the tax. I don't have any tax advantage accounts.
Well, but this is
when you're low income, a tax credit doesn't do that much for you.
No, the idea that you're going to have the idea that you're going to increase savings by just simply meaning that you can avoid taxes by putting is absurd. This is a giveaway to wealthy people. And it, to the extent that they use it. I mean, so
it also echoes Paul Ryan, frankly. Ryan would say all the time that, I mean, you remember he literally had a proposal that I want to give poor people life coaches to help them manage their finances and plan. And it was like,
give them or give them like a tax advantage, like a savings tax account.
He should get the wall for that. Seriously.
I remember.
I mean, I would take a free life coach.
Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, yeah.
Upper middle class people would definitely take a free life coach.
I will take a free life coach.
Yes.
I've been begging that for a long time.
But not for being totally broke.
Maybe now the children of the professional managerial class will finally get to go to college.
But it is amazing, though. Like, there's something, I think what stands out about this, at least in my mind, is it's one thing to not be embracing the current and the energy of things like Medicare for All and the surge of, let's just say, social democracy broadly. But the fact that this actually, it's not like I support a Medicare buy-in instead of Medicare for All. This is like, I want to run on George W. Bush 2000. Like a compassionate conservative PPI that basically ends up benefiting wealthy people. That is the level of disconnect there. And this speaks to her staff and everybody.
Well,
it's awe-inspiring.
When I read this, I think of like
internal subterfuge.
When I see this, I think of like you see a commercial shot or some video shot and the lighting is really bad.
Right.
Or someone has a piece of hair sticking up and I think like, oh, the crew hates that that person. They're not going to tell them that they've got, you know.
So we should tweet this out.
Snots. And they're like, oh, this is going to be great. When people realize that you've paired with Ben Sass on this. Like, I don't even know. Like, there isn't. I don't even think there's like. I don't even think, like, what's his face? Chuck Todd looks at this and goes, wow. Like, I don't think there's anybody like left.
I think Ben Sasse, if you're working with Ben Sasse, and you think this is he's a good guy and, you know, we could reach across the aisle. I mean, you're a sucker. That's it. Plain and simple. And Ben Sasse says, I think if we're talking about throwing stuff up and seeing what works, in a way to dissuade people from developing class consciousness, I think Ben Sasse has a very dangerous tack there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true.
And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
The law. Coming soon.
What is it? Say it. Repeat it one more time.
And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
I'm not ready to take those risks. That sounds risky.
Remember Ben Sasse's face after Bill Maher said the thing that he got in trouble for? That was funny.
Is there an acronym we can come out of there? RI, of a new kind of.
And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
Do you know what that means?
The Artioncup Act coming soon.
You got to hear it again.
Risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
A solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
Risks you put the imagination at risk, so you gamble with it. We'll gamble the imagination, right, of possibility.
It's or no. There's a possibility you will lose your imagination.
Well, wait a second. Honestly, for the life of me, like, I can't figure out what this means.
Well, there's an. It starts with an it, so it probably depends on the antecedent of it.
It sounds like you translated the phrase audacity of hope into like 80 different languages and then back into English.
Exactly.
This is audacity of hope translated into Swahili.
That's the way
and
that
back
they
into
up,
English.
That's the way that they come up with like
Japan
website
at some
names.
Point.
That's the way they come up with website names, I think. Right. It's like they do a lot of like just like cross translating until they just sort of like it's so far away.
Yeah, and but this like, is not like putting,
you know,
people
baboo.com and it started out as.
And that's what his books are like, too. It's just all full of crap like that. He talks about going on... Shoot, sorry, this was a while ago. But I vaguely remember he talked about going on some corporate retreat.
Nice.
That was like kind of like one of those stupid like Primal Screen type things, you know, for the freaking C-suite. And that was one where he paid some consultant, some fake guru, like a hell of a lot of money to lead them on this thing, to, you know, get him, you know, get the C-suite recharged and ready to tackle the challenges of a new business day. So I think hiring consultants, paying a lot of money to consultants who ultimately don't ever do anything, that's something Howard Schultz
right,
is
that's part
used
of the course.
To, yeah.
Oh, well, I think
part
wealthy people do that broadly
promise.
Speaking. I think wealthy people do that all the time. Consultants is the whole thing.
I've just received a point from Sean, my woke bae, who's in a union. And he has noted that unions do not charge for apprenticeship programs. They actually pay you to work in them. So this tweet is not talking about good union jobs when they say apprenticeships. They're talking about some neoliberal serfdom garbage.
Maybe, I feel like Sean is risking the imagination of a new kind of possibility when he says that.
I think Amy Klobuchar is saying, like, maybe you could start a podcast.
Well, you know what it is? It's more personal responsibility bullshit,
right, well, that's
which
why
I'm very opposed to. I'm opposed to personal responsibility. Yes. I want less of it, far less of it than I currently
that's
have.
Right.
I cannot manage my own affairs. I spend, you
You're
know,
well-dressed. I mean,
I'll take responsibility for that. But,
right.
You know, that's kind of consuming a lot of my time. I can't. I mean, I remember when I used to buy the health insurance on the public markets and on the exchanges. And I just spend, you know, for 15 minutes doing this. And then I think, oh, I don't want responsibility anymore. I don't want this. I want a bureaucrat to decide what health insurance I get. I want to be put on the road to serfdom if it means I don't have to look at this fucking website.
Diane Abbott. Who's in, she's, I think she's on the labor front bench, but a couple years ago when she was like, you know, very treated, and they still are treated in a very marginal way by the British press, which is unbelievable. But she said that point. I think actually, you know, she was contesting leadership before Corbyn when it was Ed Miliband, and she didn't, you know, go anywhere for. But there was a segment where they were talking about all of these like Blairite interventions and things like the NHS, and she's like, poor people don't need to have to make more choices and more responsibilities. They already have more than you do. They already have far more stress, far more things to deal with. And this is not liberatory. It's actually – like choice is oppressive. Mm-hmm. She effectively right. flipped that. And they were all just like, I didn't know. They didn't buy it.
Let me ask you about this. You know, I don't know if you have more you want to talk about the 2020 candidates at this point.
Yeah, if you want, whatever.
Well,
you want.
I mean, what was your sense of Kamala Harris's rollout?
I mean, it was very successful for her, and you know, I think that's reflected in the poll numbers. Which again, it's early; it doesn't really freaking matter. But it seemed to go pretty smoothly, and you have the whole kind of contretemps from the left, all this criticism of her prosecutorial record, which. I'm really of two minds about that because some of the stuff that I've seen that's come out of her speeches about that time has been very, very gross stuff. You know, it's there's some meat on the bones with the criticism of her record that I'm not sure whether or not that's actually going to drive a wedge between her and the voters she's going to try to appeal to.
Right.
And I'm wondering, well, should this come out now? And isn't that better for her? If we're all talking about this now and then we just forget about it in a year from now when the first votes are cast, or is it good that this is out now and more people are firmed up and saying, you know, no, I can't support this, or there needs to be some kind of, you know,
some of
explanation.
Those clips would have been nice if they dropped a couple of days before Iowa.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think that there is enough broad-based concern in the Democratic Party that would set an alarm. I think it's will there be criticism, essentially from people of color and activists who care about criminal justice reform, who are going to provide the legitimacy of critique of her, right? Because there seems to me to be, look, the game plan for the Clinton folk, and this is not to diminish the reality of misogyny, but the game plan for the Clinton folk, and to a certain extent, the game plan of the Obama folks, which is obviously not to make a claim about the legitimacy of racism, obviously, but. That is, like, we're going to build this force field, and it is going to make it difficult to criticize willy-nilly about certain things. And I think with Kamala Harris, I think they're going to use, you know, I think there's going to be this sense, and we hear a little bit of it, like, you know, critiquing her. She's a woman. And we're talking about at a time where the energy in the Democratic Party is undoubtedly coming from women. Mm-hmm. Who are more or less Kamala Harris's age and coming from people of color, particularly women. And so this is the most energized constituency, the most reliable constituency of the Democratic Party. And I think, like, there has to be a valid critique of that prosecutorial stuff from people who've worked on it for a long time,
yeah.
Right? Like,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
It has to come from people who have legitimate stakes in that issue. It can't be, you know, folks who just don't like Kamala Harris because they like another candidate.
But also, look, like, okay, I just found out yesterday that a mother of seven who was sent to jail because she couldn't pay her truancy fines died in her cell. And, like, I'm allowed to be mad about that whether or not I found out about it yesterday or a few years ago when it happened.
Right.
The other thing is, I think Harris's game plan going forward, and you pretty much saw this in her rollout, is to just stake out, you know, leftish positions on criminal justice reform, and hopefully that, you know, just absolves her of whatever past sins that she said. You know, I support ending cash bail. I support abolishing private prisons, which I think is a mainstream Democratic plank at this point.
Well, Obama had done that for federal prisons already.
Right, right. And I think just saying these things, that's going to be enough for most people.
I agree. You're gonna need to have activists come up who can really launch an attack that is really that has enough legitimacy that people can't sort of like push back on it, that they're going to have to actually address it. So it's going to be interesting to see if that happens.
So to that extent, I think she's very well positioned right now, and it's hard to see there being that many roadblocks ahead for her.
I think it's almost like, it's very hard to imagine that if there are three or four people at the end of this race, or two, even two or three, that she's not one of them.
Oh, yeah.
Well, maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I do not think these issues are going away. If anything, I think people are becoming more and more conscious of them every day, especially considering the stakes involved. Like, people are dying because of these policies. And just to use another example, sex workers are becoming a real vocal constituency pretty much for the first time in U.S. politics. And something like Sesta Fosta, which she pushed very hard, is still leading to the deaths of sex workers, and I don't think people are going to shut up about it. The question is, like, you know, is the mainstream going to care?
She pushed it hard, but the thing about that is, and this goes back to your point, Sam, about having the legitimacy of that criticism, all of her opponents also voted for Sesta Fosta.
Yeah. Yeah, but she pushed the policy.
But
some people are more implicated than others.
That's
and
true.
I think it is something.
Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are definitely the most implicated in criminal justice issues, period. I mean, she prosecuted and put all sorts of people in jail that shouldn't be there. And Joe Biden wrote the 94 crime bill.
The other person who could be well positioned to make that argument is Cory Booker. Who, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if he raises that.
He will. He how could he not? I mean, that's one of the only areas because he doesn't – I mean, I'm sure he embraced some aggressive tactics in Newark as mayor. But he doesn't have a particular reputation for that. And the first legislation that he signed when he got into the Senate was actual pretty serious criminal justice reform packages and marijuana legalization.
That's his brand.
He should be all over that. That would be political malpractice for him not to. I also think, like, I want to look again at how HIV/AIDS activists targeted Al Gore when he ran for president, because Al Gore was notorious because he had the direct bilateral responsibility relationship with South Africa, and he threatened to sanction them if they put out generic AIDS drugs. And it was a huge controversy, and actually he did have to reverse himself in what was, like, I don't think a competitive primary in 2000 at all for the Democratic primary. But I think if you – even in that environment, which was – totally different politically, and he didn't have as serious a threat. He did have to reverse himself and felt some heat because of how targeted and specific it was. So people should look at that maybe as a model for how to be on Kamala Harris. But they still went after it in the context of reversing positions, though,
right.
Not just relitigating.
What she's not going to be able to go back to California.
No, but her answers could be more satisfactory than some people just don't like prosecutors, and I don't apologize for being one.
Yeah.
And as well, keep in mind, I mean, that's, you know, we're talking about using pressure to change what a candidate who's trying to get elected says. And that's no guarantee whatsoever they'll do in office, you know. And like the good example of that is the Obama administration and its entirety.
But do you think that the Obama administration promised stuff that the bankruptcy bill cram down was the first big, sort of reversal, it seems to me. But everything else, I think, in terms of what Obama promised,
what was it?
Short of the public option, which it was, they delivered on. But the problem is that people didn't require the same level of promise.
Right. There's that ambiguity there. Right. But Obama did, even on the campaign trail, go back on certain things. Most famously,
NAFTA.
NAFTA's one, domestic spying's another, and most famously...
But he cast that vote when he was still in the Senate.
Right.
Most famously, the, what do you call it, the healthcare requirement.
The
mandate.
The mandate.
No, mandate, yes.
Yes, he argued against the mandate in the...
he argued for the public option and against the mandate.
So, I mean, the real problem here is, you know, if you want to police a candidate's positions, if you want to guarantee, you have to attack the source of where the positions come from, which is just its money. And that's it. And if I can be pretty certain that this candidate will oppose private prisons if they are taking $0 from the private prison industry. But if this person is taking millions of dollars from private prison interests and then saying on the trail, well, you know, gosh, we got to look at these private prisons. I personally oppose them. I can be pretty certain that that's all bullshit. With these criminal justice issues, it's a bit thornier, right? I mean, the pressures there are more dispersed. It's not like, you know, I'm the police brutality union and here's a shitload of money.
Mm-hmm. It's like interesting, though. I mean, we look at like the Medicare bills that Harris herself has signed on to. Right. She signed on to Bernie's Medicare for All, but she's also signed on to Brian Schatz's Medicare buy-in. And she's also signed into a third one. I can't remember who's sponsoring it. That basically just rolls out the public option.
Yeah.
In ACA. So she signed on all of those. She's already, you know, created some wiggle room on the Medicare for All thing. But it does, you know, if every single Democratic candidate comes out for Medicare for All, you're going to see people down ticket also support these things. And there's going to be just a broad based expectation that that people are going to be held to account.
That said, I mean, for what it's worth, and the dynamics inside the Democratic and Republican parties are very different. But I mean, it is interesting, and maybe in a sick way it speaks well of Democrats that they're not, I guess, not as lying as aggressively to their constituencies. But like Republicans voted to take down Obamacare, what was it, like over 100 times or something when they weren't in
power? 57 times.
Yeah, right, while they weren't in power. And then they got into power, and granted, there's a lot of variables, but they couldn't get it together to do it. Democratic leadership won't even do like a symbolic, let's pass Medicare for All out of the House to rev our people up.
Yeah.
And then we know it's going to get killed in the Senate. They won't even do that.
I'm not convinced that that's the case.
Well, we'll see.
They're about to do that with Social Security expansion now.
Social
they have
Security,
200.
That's past the, that's, that is in a different in place. That's
well,
definitely happening.
But I mean, but.
Also, that's
I will
less
remind
aggressive.
You that 6 years ago, less.
I know.
Barack Obama was still actively trying to cut Social Security.
I was trying to cut those devil security checks.
And we since have had the Democratic caucus in the Senate vote to expand it, and there are now 200-some-odd co-sponsors. Co-sponsors in
the House. It's great,
but
I mean, the stakes of expanding Social Security are definitely smaller than Medicare for All, obviously.
I mean, the
political implications of saying we are going to pass a bill that eliminates private insurance is a absolutely different order of magnitude than expanding a massively successful pre-existing 1930s program. Those are different things.
That's true. But the idea of expansion of Social Security, if you had brought it up 6 or 7 years ago, you would look like you were coming from Mars.
Well, and nobody brought up Medicare for All 6 or 7 years ago.
Well, that's right.
So, right.
But, yeah. And we also have,
except for Bernie,
now, even from a policy standpoint, right, the entirety of the Democratic Party understands the insufficiency of a program that we have now. So there's almost like, you know, there is almost an ironclad guarantee that something is going to be done. And it's going to have to be meaningful because everyone understands that we're going to get back to this place. How meaningful it is, it's unclear. But we also have three competing bills coming out of the Senate on how to deal with prescription drugs, ranging from Warren's, you know, generic manufacturing of generics,
which is awesome,
but also purchasing and whatnot. And even Trump today announced that HHS is going to get rid of the benefit managers for Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, these are we're moving on that front in a because it is non-elective. In some way, I think for everyone, everyone knows that something is deeply broken. Social Security is more of like an elective, right? We're just going to make this more generous.
I just want to know, like, if you believe that healthcare is a right and should be free for everybody at point of service, yada, yada, and you've seen all the data and all the statistics on the only good way to make that happen, why you would hedge by also supporting this one that's a little nicer to private insurance companies. Like, what possible good faith reason could you have for that?
I mean, that you think it's more doable, that it's a negotiation point? I mean...
Well, I think the problem, and this is the problem the reformists run into, is that health insurance is a sector of the economy. It's very, very, very complicated. And the strategic thinking here is, well, you know, Donald Trump is president, Republicans control of the Senate. Why bother forcing a tough vote right now? Why even put out legislation that, you know, then Republicans go back and run ads and say, you know, you will lose your private health insurance.
Right.
I mean, and that's tough. I mean, I think that the moral position has to be to go to war with the health insurance companies and to drum up popular support against them, to demonize them, to villainize them, because what actually needs to happen is this, the seizure of every private health insurer. Like, that's it. It's what, $1 trillion just go to profits every single year off, you know, misery.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's a sector of the economy that should not exist.
It shouldn't exist.
The parasite sector.
100% of their profits off of denying care to people.
As Ryan Krueger pointed out, yes, a lot of that $1 trillion is going to go to war against any one of these proposals.
Yes.
Any single one of them.
Indeed.
So you have to suit up for war, and that means every single Democrat, even the blue dogs, cannot be taking money from the health insurance companies. Mm-hmm. But they are, and they're going to. And that's the sort of thing that watered down the ACA. And it was the intent to it was the resistance of the health insurance companies in 1993 that ended Clinton Care.
You know, I mean, the interesting thing is, and I'll tell you why, like a Medicare buy-in or one of the things that we're going to, like, it almost seems to me to be definitive. We're going to see Medicare age drop. Right, we're going to see it drop to like 55 is a total no-brainer, and this is something the insurance industry was in favor of before the ACA showed up, because if they could offload that other segment, that age group, which was probably, you know, aside from pre-existing conditions, the worst part of their risk pool, and they could offload that to the government. Then they would have, you know, 20 to 55-year-olds, and, you know, that's a business I wouldn't mind being in. I'll insure them for health things, particularly if I get to exclude pre-existing conditions, because that's a winner. And prior to that, they did not have a business model that could actually sustain itself as the baby boomers got older. And with the millennials coming in, they had all this money that is there that is fairly safe bet that most of these people are not going to have to draw on their insurance that much, and they're going to make their profits.
Yeah.
And so,
and that's the structure of the industry. And, you know, that's exactly what charter schools want to turn education into.
Yes.
We're going to get the kids that are easy.
Exactly. That is exactly
and
right.
So, so the thing is, the fight right now is the center of that fight is to prevent that from happening, this private sector takeover of the education sector. I think the goalposts need to be moved. I think the center of the fight over healthcare needs to be moved towards that.
Yes.
I was trying to think of a football thing, and I just totally
no,
blanked.
Goalposts.
Goalposts
is a very reliable image.
No, the
cheerleaders.
Cheerleaders
you just need to switch
to move
sides.
The cheerleaders to the other team.
Yeah,
they got to be put in the skyboxes. all right. Well, let's take a break and head into the fun half of the program, and then we'll continue to do what we're doing.
Sounds good.
Or we could just freebie Friday
touchdown.
Goal.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about this abortion stuff, because I think we're going to. I think this is I just have a sense that this is going to come back. And Brendan was telling me that he thinks I'm just having like PTSD from the Bush years. But
that should be your autobiography.
Yeah, I've got like
PTSD
three of them
from the Bush years. By Sam Cedar.
I
and Janine Garofalo.
It just
with a forward and afterward by
exactly.
Janine Garofalo.
It just seems to me that Trump is desperate to find something right now that is going to change the subject, that is also going to be and focusing stuff on the Supreme Court as a reason to reelect him. all the ducks seemed lined up in the row, and this is an opportunity. Here is a clip of Ralph Northam. He is the governor of Virginia, of course, talking about, we played the clip the other day from, there was a Virginia lawmaker. She was being questioned on the law that they are pushing that it is legal this day to provide abortion services to a woman who is signed off by a doctor for medical reasons to receive an abortion as late as 40 weeks. Could be literally a day before labor begins, because if it is a threat to the mother's life, and if it is a threat to the mother's health, and it is a function of the viability of the child. And here is Northam, and it was fascinating. I barely saw this, but he does this interview, and this was spun by the right as saying that Northam says it's okay to kill children after they to kill children who are born. And here is that interview, and then we'll talk more about it.
There are no exception. There was a very contentious committee hearing yesterday when Fairfax County Delegate Kathy Tran made her case for lifting restrictions on third trimester abortions, as well as other restrictions now in place. And she was pressed by a Republican delegate about whether her bill would permit an abortion, even as a woman is essentially dilating, ready to give birth. And she answered that it would permit an abortion at that stage of labor. Do you support her measure, and explain her answer?
Yeah, and I wasn't there, Julie, and I certainly can't speak for Delegate Tran, but I will tell you, first thing I would say is this is why decisions such as this should be made by providers, physicians, and the mothers and fathers that are involved. There are, when we talk about third trimester abortions, these are done with the consent of obviously the mother, with the consent of the physicians, more than one physician, by the way. And it's done in cases where there may be severe deformities, there may be a fetus that's non-viable. So in this particular example, if a mother is in labor, I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be delivered. The infant would be kept comfortable. The infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired. And then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mother. So I think this was really blown out of proportion. But again, we want the government not to be involved in these types of decisions. We want the decision to be made by the mothers and their providers. And this is why, Julie, that legislators, most of whom are men, by the way, shouldn't be telling a woman what she should and shouldn't be doing with her body.
And do you think multiple physicians should have to weigh in, as is currently required? She's trying to lift that requirement.
Well, I think it's always good to get a second opinion, and for at least two providers to be involved in that decision, because these decisions shouldn't be taken lightly. And, mm-hmm. and so, I would certainly support more than one provider.
All right. Let's go back to
now. Of course, in some instances, there aren't more than one provider, right? I mean, if you're living in a rural area, there aren't necessarily multiple doctors on call who are working in obstetricians, and so, but this is very reminiscent of the Terri Schiavo thing. Because when you're talking about these children, if a child is born and the doctors know that this child has no internal organs, or, is missing internal organs, or has, can survive perhaps for 3 or 4 days in this instance, that's what we're talking about here in these instances. And this is very much like the Terri Schiavo situation, which I don't know if you guys remember.
You should refresh people.
Terri Schiavo was a woman who was in a vegetative state, and her she had, before entering into that state, she had a conversation with her husband that he would pull the plug. Her parents did not want to, and the U.S. Senate was trying to get involved and into this decision. because there were protesters out there, and it became this big political football, and it was very successful for the Republicans. It was a very successful...
Was it? No, it wasn't.
Ultimately, I think it was successful insofar as it was a way of rallying. They lost, but they lost this battle. But it was a way of rallying the evangelicals. Now,
what year sure, did that but they, happen, but though? That was 2005. They lost the battle.
Yeah, they lost the midterms badly, right?
Very badly. And as well, they, if you look at polls from that period, the vast majority of Americans said, "What? No, the Senate should not be involved in this issue."
I agree. But I do think that it hardened their base. 2006 was not about Terry Schiavo.
It was for me.
It was not about
Terry Schiavo.
And I think abortion,
she must die.
Yes.
abortion, I think, has a different resonance than in that instance, right? As an adult, you had the husband there. He came out. And I just can't help but think that at the very least, Trump is going to try and make this that type of thing.
I think regardless of the direct comparison, you know, whether we go with it one way or another, I mean, you're 100% right in terms of abortion is just the way of reaffirming, like you said earlier, the one thing that he's absolutely kept his word on, which is I'm going to fill the court with the most extreme retrograde people imaginable. And I'm going to take, an axe to everything. Obviously, regulation on the corporate sector first and foremost, but the whole evangelical agenda as well. And if that is put back into the center of their minds for his reelect, that bodes better for him. I still think he's in pretty tough shape no matter what.
Yeah, it goes back to that chart that you showed yesterday, right, Michael, about how most voters are either socially liberal or socially conservative, but definitely not economically conservative.
Right.
And people underestimate the degree to which Trump won on this vague economic populism that he injected into his rhetoric combined with social conservatism, and he could do it again.
I don't think he will, but I think that that's the best play. But I also don't ever take the Democrats could always snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. So.
We'll see. I think he's going to talk about abortion quite a bit.
And do you think he's been personally responsible for abortions?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if he's ever had sex.
I don't think he's a provider, if that's what you mean.
Yeah. It's like my dad and I got into the provider business, helped a lot of women.
Okay. I'm gonna be an annoying SJW now, as I am most of the time, and remind everyone that it's not only women who can get pregnant and need abortions. It's hard for me to remember, too, but you got to try.
Okay. Fair enough. I don't know Donald Trump's involvement in that there, but
he's provided abortions in every single scenario. He was actually, that was his life's purpose. He was supposed to be an abortion provider, but he wanted to please his dad.
He'll talk about abortion a lot, sure, but at this point, I just don't think anything moves the needle anymore.
No.
You're not convincing anyone, and these socially conservative voters, these the hardcore evangelical types. They're already 100% going to vote for him. Like, that's it. There's not going to be any dissension in those ranks.
No, I mean, I am still firmly in the Martin O'Malley can win camp, and I think it's a question though of how motivated these voters will be to come out. That it's not a question of convincing anybody. It's a question of turnout. It seems to me.
They're going to turn out because they always turn out. They turned out in the midterms, and they turned out big for Republicans.
Yep.
So they're going to turn out because that's what they do. That's a lot of them are just old people with nothing else to do, and it's of course that's always what it comes down to. At the end of the day, it's the judges. You want the judges. I gave you two judges, probably three by then.
Right. That's going to be super scary. Here is let's Jesus look at this clip of Elizabeth Warren. Who is going on Bloomberg and talking about her brand. And I'm curious.
I'm sorry. Do you remember Bloomberg's book title? Speaking of good book titles. It was really good. Is there any guesses?
The bloom is off the rose.
Let a thousand flowers bloom.
Oh, God, no. It was Bloomberg on Bloomberg.
Oh.
That's good.
That's good.
That's him.
They rejected Bloomberg, Bloomberg, Bloomberg as the that was the working title. Here's Elizabeth Warren talking about taxation on, I think this was on Bloomberg. And it's interesting. Well, let's play this clip first.
Capitalism without rules is theft. Encouraging companies to build their business models on cheating people, that's not capitalism. That's not competition in the marketplace. That's not producing consumer surplus. So what I believe is capitalism with serious rules. And that means rules where everybody gets a chance to play.
The surplus now, is the theft.
Well, all right. So God, let me just ask you. So Bernie Sanders obviously running on, or at least his pedigree, right, is democratic socialism,
yeah.
You know. Hers is a reformation of capitalism. That said, she's suggested that the government seize the means of production when it comes to when it comes to generic drugs. Her proposals, how much at the end of the day do you think their proposals land differently from each other, and how relevant is that difference?
I don't know, because she's been throwing up a lot of stuff in the past past few weeks now, and I mean, the legislative proposals from Democratic senators have all been for show for the past few years now. That being said, you know, I'm excited by some of the things that she's proposed. For instance, opening up corporate boards and having labor representation on them, which would actually, I think, be a sea change in the way that American capitalism works. The thing about Warren is, in contrast to the other reformist candidates, she's the only one who seems actually reformist. She actually seems to believe what she says. She seems to actually position herself in opposition to the interests of capital, which is not something we've seen from any Democratic nominee for a long time now. So that being said, as far as the left goes, Warren is a perfectly acceptable candidate.
I guess it depends how much it matters to you, how much you think the rhetoric matters, right? Because there are people who would support Bernie over Warren, people on the socialist left, because Bernie is coming from a place of democratic socialism, structural reform, critique of capitalism, yada, yada. I think he's more of a social democrat than any kind of anti-capitalist, but whatever. Whereas Elizabeth Warren is coming from a place of reforming capitalism. So the outcomes might look relatively similar, but it just matters if you care that people are hearing those words, you know?
I'm very glad with what Warren's doing. And if he doesn't run, I'm happy to push my support over. But I mean, I think there are these subtle differences that do matter in terms of how you frame. I'm less worried about the words, but I'm like, to me, there is also just some unmovable facts here that, like, because she opted not to run in 2016, where maybe she could have very well actually defeated Hillary Clinton,
yeah,
which would have been incredible. But it's like, Bernie did it, and Bernie has an entire. I mean,
all right. I want to stay on this point, though. I don't want to get in. I just want to stay specifically on this point. You know, whether he deserves it or not.
I'm talking about deserves. He's the most popular politician in America.
Yeah, I don't. That's not what I'm talking about. I want to talk about, like, in terms of, at the end of the day, is she going to be able to even go further in terms of her reformation or proposals than Bernie, because she is making it like it's reforming capitalism, as opposed to, rhetorically speaking, I want to replace the system.
Oh, capital does not care about that.
Right. I mean, I couldn't tell you. I have absolutely no idea what the next thing Liz Warren is going to say. I mean, that being said, is she going to, you know, roll out, I propose the nationalization of every major industry.
Right.
And it's just sort of something we all accept that she believes now.
Well, who would be the constituency that would speak? Because in terms of the base, they don't care. And in terms of the elites, they don't
care.
If
Bernie Sanders came out with, we should have the government make generic drugs.
Right.
I feel like there would be people's hair would go
from
on
who?
Fire. I think we're going to hear that from other candidates. I think we could hear that from a Kamala Harris, conceivably.
Conceivably, but I mean, at some point, they're all going to critique each other's proposals. But in terms of the voting public, and then, of course, like Wall Street doesn't care either way, who in like an actual mass body of voters would that make any difference with?
Well, I don't know that anybody's proposals or any of the rhetoric will make a big difference with anybody. But I'm just saying that the question is that can Elizabeth Warren go further under the guise of capitalist reform than Bernie Sanders can go because he is labeled as a socialist?
I guess we'll see.
Well, okay. That we could have wrapped this up 2.5 hours ago.
I don't see that.
Like, she is more acceptable to the mainstream of the Democratic Party. And I think that is something that will help her in the primary, not in the general.
Okay. And so if that's the case, is there a substantive difference? Substantive, not rhetorical, not pedigree. Just I want to isolate it. This is what I'm trying to get at. A substantive difference in terms of their proposals at this point. And to the extent that there is, are hers, you know, and I would say putting aside foreign policy, because I think that it clearly.
Can you, though?
But for the course of the conversation, we can.
I want to answer this in two ways. First, neither person has announced that they're running for president.
Correct.
Right now. There's no.
Warren has announced that she's going to announce on the 9th.
Right.
She'll do it. Certainly.
But there's no, kind of two column comparison that we can make right now and then, you know, take a microscope and say, oh, well, this one's actually more left than that other one. What we do know about the two candidates is that Bernie Sanders has never been a Democrat in his life. He is, despite currently being in the Democratic Senate leadership, he is a socialist, proclaims a socialist, and ostensibly this means he wants to be a part of a burgeoning socialist movement in the country that can operate as a political force. Liz Warren, of course, says she's a capitalist, but I believe also she's very serious about reform and government intervention there, and perhaps even challenging the power of capital. No great authority than Jonathan Chait actually pointed this out and was 100% correct when he said that socialists view the Democratic Party not as partners or something that they want to build, but as a marriage of convenience.
Right.
And mm-hmm. with liberals and with, sadly, quite a lot of conservatives in that party. I believe that one priority right now, and that socialists have the best opportunity to do this, is to take over the Democratic Party and to clean house. And that means getting rid of that right flank and getting rid of the influence of capital within the party. And that goes back to my earlier point about challenging the power of health insurance companies and not having any Democrats take money from health insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and defense contractors and Wall Street and so on and so forth.
So part of it, then, is how you're measuring the power of the bully pulpit. Like, maybe part of my bias is that, like, part of how I don't see the question working for me is I just think that where it does matter rhetorically is that his baseline of that kind of fundamental challenge already puts the goalposts so far in a different left direction that's a parameter resetter in and of itself. And we'll see whether or not it works. But I don't, you know.
Yeah. And I also object to divorcing it from foreign policy. Because really, you can't. If you're going to have like a regulated capitalism and welfare state in one country, someone has to pay for that, right? And it's going to be paid for by imperial plunder. Like a socialist vision is a vision that has to extend to the whole world. And we've seen Bernie taking some very positive steps in the right direction to form that like progressive international with Yanis Varoufakis.
And Warren actually does have, she put out a decent liberal foreign policy manifesto, but it's very interesting because it parallels like essentially we should get back to almost like JFK stuff in the early 60s, which is like, don't be such a dick and help people develop and have some fair trade agreements. But when you don't talk about global oligarchy, when you don't talk about Lula, when you don't talk about restoring the Iran deal, you're leaving so much on the table.
And this certainly matters when we're talking about something like a Green New Deal, which thankfully we are talking about now. Mike Bloomberg says he's going to announce his Green New Deal plan. AOC is going to announce her Green New Deal plan.
I'm going to pass the money on everyone.
But the thing is, I don't... I obviously don't like Bloomberg, and if he were the Democratic nominee, I would probably be opposed to him, I'd have to say. That being said, I'm very curious what's in his Green New Deal, because just from reading some of his past statements, the outline of it sounds like something that, you know, a lot of people could get behind.
Environmentally, I have a feeling he'll be very strong.
You know, we have
he'll
to,
be good.
We have to transition away from a carbon-based economy, and, you know, that has to be matched with replacing those jobs that are lost and economic investment in places like West Virginia. Okay, the outline of that sounds good. Even if we were going to avoid the question of how do you pay for it, you know, without any sort of wealth transfers, which Bloomberg is opposed to. The thing is, we're just talking about a Green New Deal in domestically as a way to eliminate our emissions, which is possible. It's very feasible. We have the capital, we have the labor, we have know-how, and we have the material inputs to do that. If we were the only country that does that, that does absolutely nothing.
Right.
Whatsoever. So Giannis is campaigning on a Green New Deal across Europe right now, and he's coordinating with Bernie, so that also adds to the answer. And I would just say,
here's my Green New Deal. I'm going to buy China.
Public offer to China to buy all of them.
Buy China.
And that's a good example. Europe's been reducing emissions for the past two decades. Several European countries are emissions neutral, and that has done nothing.
That's exactly right. And also, not only that, I mean, I think as far as Bloomberg's green policies, environmental policies go, and again, I don't mean this all critically at all, but just look at what Jerry Brown's done in California. Actually, on the transition and tech side, he's done some really good things. But if you have a concept – but on the drill and supply side, he hasn't, and I doubt Bloomberg would either. And if you also conceive of the environment as being connected to people's needs and whole – and things like environmental justice and other things that would be part of an AOC vision, Jerry Brown's not been particularly good. So, I mean, there's a – like, look, if the choice is Trump, you know, or Jerry Brown or Bloomberg, you pick Jerry Brown or Bloomberg. But we're trying to put forth something different here.
And I would say that any – my starting position in terms of Green New Deal or any sort of policy, which again is this protean concept right now, would be the seizure of every energy company in the country.
Right.
That has to be it. And you
Hell
need
yeah.
to use their capital that they've accumulated destroying the planet for the past century in order to repair the planet.
And if Warren comes out tomorrow and says,
nationalization, I just think seizure just seems a little bit abrupt. I think nationalization just sounds a lot more.
And if when
the right wing got very scared, or I guess they're still scared of it right now, that, oh, Trump is going to sign this executive order and he's going to do that, which is going to make a unilateral capital outlay, and we're going to seize land at the border. What's going to prevent a socialist Democrat president from signing executive order day one saying, well, it's an actual climate emergency, as we all know at this point. We're going to seize the assets.
We're going to start with the refineries and then
every
we'll
single
our way back with
energy
that.
Company.
If
and
Warren,
we're going to redirect those resources. And I think that has to happen. That would be great.
The most fun candidate would be someone like Tony Blair or Bill Clinton or Kamala Harris explaining why the real third way position is seizing all oil companies' assets. That's what I would do if I ran for office. I would explain that it's a new form of a public-private partnership while I'm lining people up against the wall.
Back to the question of party, it's really not totally clear to me. I am more skeptical than some of my more like orthodox Trotskyist comrades in DSA on the question of the party, right? Because I think, you know, these are folks who think we need a socialist party. We need a socialist party that is also a labor party. It is not this bizarre cross-class alliance that we have right now in the Democratic Party of workers and bosses, labor and capital. But like every time we've seen a socialist party succeed at taking power, they have ultimately failed. Like, look at what happened with Syriza in Greece. Like, everything is just so overdetermined by the wider political economic climate. That said, I would still prefer...
Syriza uniquely did not have the ability in their position to do much more than they
exactly.
did.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, but Jeremy Corbyn has more room to move. Bernie Sanders would have more room to
move. Well, we'll see. But it hasn't worked yet. To be fair, nothing has worked yet, I can't totally write it off. But that said, I would still rather have a socialist party in the U.S. than the Democratic Party that we have now.
Here's a good counterpoint to that. A big reason why these left electoral movements have failed is precisely because they, even getting elected on a national level in a place like Greece or Venezuela, doesn't give you the actual levers of power that you need to make fundamental changes to society. And an interesting news story for the past week is the, I believe the British Royal Bank, which has control over Venezuela's gold reserves, is being urged to assign that over, the country's wealth, to this insurrectionary who's calling himself president.
They are.
And they are doing that.
Yeah.
If you're the president of the United States and you're picking the chairman of the Federal Reserve, you're picking the head of the World Bank and the head of the IMF, I think you have a bit more power at that point.
Yeah. Also, logistically, in the United States, armed revolutions are more likely than our president. That is the counterpoint to what I just said, I guess,
which is that, you know, a lot of the time it's U.S. intervention that is the primary factor in killing these movements. But, like, you know, we'll see.
All right. Let's I don't want to get too much into the weeds with this this next clip. But here is Dave Rubin.
Nice little palate cleanser.
Exactly. he is interviewing Maxime Bernier, who is a Quebecian.
That's French for Max Boot.
That's right. Yeah, he's
Quebecois Gary Johnson.
Okay. So, and who, you know, I don't know. I watched some videos of him. Like, he's, if the Proud Boys are up in Canada, he's spoken to him. He's that type of guy, right?
Oh,
I'm speaking.
You mean like he's not funny?
But I'm not speaking literally. But he's been dancing around stuff like this, and so here he is on Dave Rubin's show. And Dave Rubin, you know, it's been tough for him lately. He's dabbling. He's becoming anti-abortion curious, so he's going through a transformation right now because he's starting to realize, like, maybe it's not even worth it for me to pretend anymore.
You know, we have our sovereignty as a country, and we must be able to select our immigrants. And so that's coming from the UN. So, yes, you're right. I don't like the UN. I think that they're not so efficient. And I'm clear about that.
Yeah. Do you guys have a strain? You know, we're seeing in Europe now where there's nationalist parties, that there does seem to be a strain of sort of ethno-nationalism or something that has a different racial connotation to it. Do you guys have a strain of that in Canada? Because it seems to me that I think what's happening, and we're starting to see it here, is that if the good liberals and the good libertarians and the people who just want to live and let live, if they don't start making some advances against this radical leftism that's moving, there's going to be a lot of people that break in a bad way.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, I wouldn't be able to blame them. Yeah. And I say that as someone who has no racism in my heart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they would be left with no alternative as they watch their country crumble. Do you have any of that in Canada?
No, we don't. And it's good news. But at the end, that's why we must have this discussion.
Yeah.
And I don't fear to have this discussion.
Now, for those of you who are not watching, those of you who are not watching, you're just listening, Sam Harris is naked and they're licking his body. lying on the coffee table and they're licking his body.
I just want to say, I've always liked the Rubin Report set because it's like a poly guy's living room. A single basketball in a glass cubby.
Yeah.
You picture him and he's about to pull out a Go set and care for a game of the ancient Oriental...
I don't even know. Dave Rubin here is like basically saying that the SJWs are forcing us to have to be ethno-nationalist in this country, I guess.
Yep.
And if we don't have the conversation, of course, it'll get worse.
Also, in a weird way, he can't blame them if they do that.
Yeah, he can't. I mean, he doesn't have any racism in his heart, but he can't blame them because they have no choice but to become white ethno-nationalists. There's no other choice.
This is like the soft bigotry of low expectations that is now starting to, like, I can think of personally, like, you know, a bunch of sort of like,
different choices.
I wouldn't say
you
they're
conservative.
Sorry, what'd you say?
Different choices you might make.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I was like, I could literally, you know, sort of centrist, you know, middle-aged, crotchety white guys who are annoyed by, like, I don't know, dumb SJW, whatever. And they've managed. They're like,
you just
they have
sports.
Not embraced white nationalism as the path of least resistance to their, like, minor irritations about internet controversies that don't matter or whatever it is that they like. Nobody went and said, like Dave Rubin was like, you know, Family Guy's not doing gay jokes anymore. I'm going to need to join the National Front.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no choice.
But it's also ironic because if anything is fueling the fires of reaction worldwide, it's this neoliberal status quo that cannot continue. It's not radical leftism.
Maybe, but I still think that those folks have a different option. Even
I'm not talking about individual psychology. I'm talking about world systems.
Ooh. Yeah. Dave seems to be talking about the individual psychology.
I'm talking about Emmanuel Wallerstein, world systems theory.
I saw
that in Wikipedia.
But I don't even think that...
He was an SJW.
I mean, I don't think that, you know, turning towards a white supremacy as an option is necessarily systemic. This system is already set up that way.
No, I'm talking about it on a totally different level than him.
Oh, well, yes.
I should hope so.
I mean, not to toot my own horn or anything.
The answer I just think, though, what's interesting is, like, okay, there's the abortion move in the last couple of days, and now there's this. I feel like – and they're going to launch their own alternative platform, and I feel like the abortion thing makes me think there's some type of partnership with Glenn Beck in the works. But that also is – like, there – and then that – but that also – I feel like the Levin and Beck, maybe you're going to see, like – they might be letting go of the, like, you know, MLK was a great guy. That's what I'm talking about. They might have to make their own transition to, like, I did some research. That guy's actually a fucking communist.
It's not inconceivable. But, I mean, look, they have no choice. And they have no other choice.
What's her name? Ayaan Hirsi Ali also said about Anders Breivik.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali literally said in 2011, I believe, that Anders Breivik, who went and committed some of the greatest atrocities in our modern era, right? He shot like 50 kids point blank
after bombing a city center
yeah. there, right? And his closing statement in his trial, and this isn't polemical. It reads like a Breitbart column. I mean, just objectively. And so, and Ayaan Hirsi Ali's big contribution to that conversation was like, well, I understand because Muslims.
And the SJW, basically the SJWs won't let us talk about Muslims.
Right, you couldn't say what he needed to say in Norway, so he needed to leave his mom's house and commit mass murder.
Well, I'm sorry that Ruben is struggling so much with this. That's all I want to say. Is that,
well, if he was willing to talk to us, maybe we could educate him.
Well, it's funny that you say that, Jamie, because, and look... this can get very juvenile. Stuff like this.
Oh,
this
boy.
Stuff. This, I mean, this is a little bit juvenile. All right. Apparently somebody set up a GoFundMe to create a billboard to mock Dave Rubin that he will not debate me, and it's going to go up in L.A. Apparently, they only needed $1,000. They dropped the amount that they did, and they're just going to leave it up there. It's going to be on a digital billboard for an extended period of time. I think that comes in there's six updates. Now, of course, this is juvenile. It's also juvenile to say, hey, let's look at this clip from TYT the other night that where they said just almost randomly this came up. That's also juvenile. And let me show you how juvenile. It's like this juvenile. Yeah, exactly.
To some degree, I have, and it's hard some days, but some degree of sympathy for Dave Rubin.
No, zero.
Yes,
because look,
he knows.
But that's the thing; he knows. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like he knows he's sold out, and so like I feel like Ben Shapiro sleeps perfectly fine at night. He's like, oh, I'm doing a great thing. This is wonderful. I'm ideologically consistent, right? Whereas like Dave Rubin, he knows.
Like he keeps denying that he's a fraud. Mm-hmm. But like everyone knows, people who watch your show and pretend like they like it, they know you're a fraud. Like the fact that he's so scared to have a conversation with Sam Cedar. It's my favorite thing in the world. I love watching it. Someone paid $100 in YouTube Super Chat, right? To ask Dave Rubin about Sam Cedar, like, why won't you debate him? And he purposely phrased the question to make it seem as though he's on Dave Rubin's side, like calling Sam Cedar an SJW. And so he's reading this comment out live. Uh-huh. And then once he starts realizing that this is a question about debating Sam Cedar, he went, don't worry about those guys. Don't worry about those. Like, he's so
precious. So, by the way, if you guys are new and you don't know, Dave used to work here. And then he went and like became a right winger, pretending to be a classic liberal, whatever the fuck that means, right? to some degree, by the Koch brothers foundations, etc. And it's just, it's a little revolting to look at. And we know for a fact that he goes and lies about his time here, right?
Yeah.
Why he left and what his experience was. We're like, what the fuck? That's not what happened at all, right?
Yeah.
But since we know for a fact that he knows that he's lying, that's what makes me think he probably has a little trouble sleeping at night. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I think I sleep like a baby. I have no conscience or intellect. It's right. It works.
Now, obviously, that type of stuff is really immature and beneath us.
I love being immature with Anna and talking about Dave Rubin. We do that every single time we do a segment together.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the serious point about it is, of course, that it's very hard for Dave, I would imagine, to maintain his core brand proposition of being someone who wants to expand the playing field for conversations and welcomes, you know, people who are from the alt-right and people who deny things like date rape onto his show. But he won't have someone on who will challenge some of his assertions about liberalism and whatnot. And so that's very difficult for Dave. And so he has to transition to other things. And so in that way, I want to say I'm sincerely sympathetic, because it would be very, very difficult, I think, to try and change your brand midstream in front of tens of thousands of people.
Are you saying that Dave is going to become a white nationalist so he doesn't have to debate you?
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that he's going to probably have to find something new, because who could possibly believe his whole branding of this of being intellectually curious under these circumstances? Honestly, like, they're not going to be, I'm sure that Barry Weiss, who was that New York Times writer who wrote about it, I'm sure now she regrets on some level that she was so hoodwinked by this, right? So that's all I'm saying.
Who's really getting hoodwinked by Dave Rubin?
I imagine she must have been, because
well, she must have been. She's a golden retriever.
Well, well, I mean, look, a lot of people like golden retrievers. I had a.
Yeah, don't say that about golden retrievers. That's mean, Virgil.
Golden retrievers are great dogs.
They're very loyal.
I would never insult golden
retrievers.
They
don't do any Hasbara.
Being deplatformed.
This is interesting. Here we go. So, Jeff Stein from the Washington Post. This morning, I confirmed with Booker's aides that he supports Medicare for All. Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill, which Booker has co-sponsored, would virtually eliminate private health insurance in more or less 4 years. However, Matt Visor, who I guess is a reporter at the Washington Post, Cory Booker asked if he would be in favor of eliminating private health insurance. No. So, you know, stuff like this makes me feel like the depth in which they have really invested into this policy is not so deep. Right? Hmm. Like, that's what the tip off here is. Like, you could say, like, I don't know if you can measure someone's, genuineness about these things, but you can measure the depth in which they have, like, spent some time with an issue. And if you don't realize that you've signed on to co-sponsor a bill that would eliminate private insurance,
then I think your any position you take on this is suspect.
Well, it's a reluctance to challenge the influence of private insurers. Yep. That's what it is.
Yep.
Wanted, everyone's talking about, oh, Medicare for all. Yeah, that's good. I support that. I want to run for president. That's the thing you say when you have to run for president in 2020.
Mm-hmm. No, and we're not talking about sort of, insurance company managed universal care. We're talking about Medicare for all.
Yeah, and they are
which
not.
Which is the moderate position, frankly, between NHS and what we have.
And they are not different versions of the same thing either. When they're like, oh, there's lots of different ways we can get to there. We can expropriate a very powerful sector of the economy, or we can do it with tax credits. Like, no, like we know that the tax credits thing doesn't work because they already tried it with Obamacare.
Yeah, and I think Bernie would be just fine if he's the only person on that stage saying, yeah, we have to eliminate the private health insurance companies and we have to rob them of their ability to dictate policy.
It'll be interesting to see how explicit Warren is when she's asked that question. She's also a co-sponsor of that.
Yeah, well, if Warren comes out and she says, and in the spirit of reform and capitalism, we need to also kill insurance companies, executives, then I think that would feed your speculation.
She had this exchange with Joe Weisenthal.
Oh, this one did not look good.
Bloomberg.
This did not look good.
Right now, your vision for Medicare for All, would it be, would it all be a public option, or would it also include private insurance? So right now, there are multiple bills on the floor of the United States. I've signed on to Medicare for All. I've signed on to another one that gives an option for buying into Medicaid. That's the Schatz bill from Hawaii. There are different ways we can get there, but the key has always been to keep the center of the bullseye in mind, and that is affordable health care for every American. Well, that's
not a great answer.
That doesn't sound so strong.
Actually, the best answer was Kamala Harris before she reversed herself.
Right.
Before she realized how
strong it was.
Literally
was just
like we're done.
We
got to
move past that. And like insurance companies? No, that's done.
Like, yes, please.
That was incredibly impressive.
Insurance companies are canceled. Yes, queen.
Here is, this is good. We're going to have on Monday, we're going to have Corey Johnson on. He is the speaker of the New York City Council. Hmm. And he's also acting public advocate. And he spoke out pretty strongly sort of grilled the Amazon of folks, which was nice to see when he came in. And now this is another Amazon one. Is this the same one?
No, they did another hearing 3 hours the other day.
Oh, they did. Okay. Here's another hearing. And he wanted to know why the city is giving such subsidies to such a wealthy company.
We are in favor of the positive economic impact this project will bring to this city.
Well, the people in Seattle don't agree with that and how they felt they've been treated by you all. So you can say that here today before you're here. But city council members from Seattle traveled to New York City to warn us about your deceptive practices, promises that you make and break, and how you swallow up small businesses, how you attempt to water down local legislation, how you lobby local government, municipal government for your own means. So if we look at what you've done in Seattle, it doesn't add up to what you're doing here today. And you are in a union city. This is a city that was built by unions, a city that loves unions, a city that has the highest per capita of union jobs in the entire United States. And one of the first answers to your question today is, would you be neutral? You said no. That is not a way to come to our city, a city where 20% of people are living at or below the poverty line.
It's nice to see somebody talking to him that way. Particularly in light of what we now know about the Foxconn deal in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting to see how much of a cautionary tale that is for folks in the city. I think a lot of people are going to be running and positioning themselves against Amazon.
Kind of makes it awkward for all the unions that support the Amazon deal.
I would imagine they're going to have to come to some type of deal with them. But it's hard, New York state politics, such a mess and cross current of transactions, it mm-hmm. seems to me mm-hmm. that. I think the key to this is my understanding. And we're going to ask Corey Johnson about this. My understanding is that these subsidies are available to anybody. any company. It's just that they're going to be hoovering up so much of it that it seems to me is problematic. Like that do we need a player with such concentrated wealth and size?
And yeah, but when you think of the synergy of having that kind of wealth near a large public housing project, I mean, just imagine the Howard Schultzian ideas.
All you
that
need
might
is like one of those skyways that they have in Minneapolis, right? And you could just folks would never have to just have like a commissary right in the middle. And people could stop off, get the food, keep walking, come back, eat, go back home, well, just like that.
Is de Blasio running for a third term?
I don't know.
I mean, that is a great sort of micro expression of progress that, in 2013 when he ran, a nice enough liberal campaign and was bold that he was even just saying there's a major inequality crisis in New York City.
People thought Quinn was going to win.
And people thought that Christine Quinn was going to win,
yep.
Who now – she works for Cuomo now. And so, I mean, yeah, if he gets challenged from somebody saying we need to do something about, say, rent control and we need to kill this Amazon deal, that's great. That's another good movement.
Oh, and P.S., the building trades unions that support this deal are not going to care. I love them. I actually have insurance through one of them, but like – no, their guys are still going to get their union rates to do all this work. And but you know what? We'll see.
All right. Let's. Do you need to go?
Yeah, I should get going. I'll see everybody tonight. Looking forward to it. And Illicit History this weekend on CLR James and Identity Politics. Yesterday, Bill Fletcher Jr. and I talked about the anti-austerity movements in Zimbabwe and Sudan, and there was extended coverage on Venezuela.
We're going to play one more clip, and then we'll get out of here soon.
Anyway. Okay, I got to go. All right, patreon.com/TMBS. Thanks, everybody.
Michael doesn't even say goodbye anymore. That's the way he says goodbye
to
anybody.
That's how I say goodbye.
That's also the way he answers his telephone.
What are you guys doing tonight? You going bowling?
There's a Michael's got a show at the Bell House.
Oh.
Now, all right, let's play this clip from AOC. It's interesting. What is shocking about this for me is that why have I been doing this for 15 years and this is the first time I'm hearing a clip of a politician say this in a hearing. It's either, yes, we've had bad research team. That could possibly be it. Now we have great researchers. Or I've been really just spinning my wheels for the better part of my adult life. So either way, it's a little bit sad in that way. But when I get past the sadness, I'm overjoyed to hear that we have someone sitting in Congress who's willing to present this case, which is a fairly obvious case. Here's AOC asking a doctor if the public gets any return on investment from the research which subsidizes all drug development. And I will say this, too. You know, I got an email from Bill Lozonik, who we've talked about quite a bit in the past, particularly in the context of stock buybacks and of the capital gains taxes and what that's done to the modern corporation in this country. And he had seen the clip about Davos with the guy from Dell. And he said he sent a couple of papers. I haven't dug into them about how much we provided the platform and the foundation as a society, specifically through our government, for Michael Dell to make all his money in computing. But here is Ocasio-Cortez making the same point in the context of drugs.
Would it be correct, Dr. Kesselheim, to characterize the NIH money that is being used in development and research as an early investment?
Yes.
So the public is acting as an early investor in the production of these drugs. Is the public receiving any sort of direct return on that investment from the highly profitable drugs that are developed from that research?
No, in most cases, there isn't. When those products are eventually handed off to a for-profit company, there aren't licensing deals that bring money back into the coffers of the NIH. That usually doesn't happen.
So the public is acting as early investor, putting tons of money in the development of drugs that then become privatized, and then they receive no return on the investment that they have made.
Right.
Hmm. That seems a little messed up.
Yeah. That's how they do it over there?
It's apparently the way you do it. You get the dumb money as the seed investment, and then the way you you take all the profits.
Yeah, public risk for private profit. That's indeed the American way.
That's because in the UK, the government doesn't have any operation to actually manufacture the pharmaceuticals. Is that right?
Wait, we're talking, this is you know, from the United States.
This is the U.S.?
That came from the United States. That was the Senate. Like, Ocasio-Cortez is not a member of Parliament.
No,
she's
I thought she
Congress.
Might have brought a British guy over
no.
to talk about the British system.
No. That guy was an American who worked
blanking.
There you go.
God, it's really, like, I keep hammering on this because I think it's so important. When we talk about neoliberalism, it's not just free markets, because if you let the free markets be free, they would fail. Neoliberal capitalism is a Hugh Hefner Viagra boner of capitalism on life support from governments who tinker around so that we can have a market.
But this isn't, I mean, this is not, this is the way that it was structured and built. I mean, this isn't a new phenomenon. This is not, in fact, what we're seeing is socialism. It just ends before our society gets the benefit, right? Because the support, I think it's perfectly legitimate that we have a government, and it's, I think it's something we want, that develops these drugs and that promotes
these
research.
But then
they
hand it over.
Right. That's not neoliberalism. I mean, it is to a certain extent. I mean, I guess it's more the classical version, right, that they were figuring out at Mont Pelerin. But the idea is that this is not coming from market. There is an absence of a market at that first level.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And so this is the problem here is just simply that we're giving away stuff as a society. I mean, it doesn't...
Taking from the public and giving to private companies.
Indeed.
That seems like a thing that happens more in the neoliberal period.
Well, it's been happening. I mean, socializing the risk and privatizing the profits has been going on, really. I mean, there's... since the founding of this country. I mean, we did it in the context of... I can't remember that book about why we have a standing military and to what was the autumn was it
that was Autumn of the Black Snake and during the revolution, for instance, the mythology of the Minuteman who just had his rifle was played up a lot for popular effect because cannons, which were the big decisive thing, were state required state investment. So, like, even back then, they were aware of, like, we need to boost this more independent sort of entrepreneurial thing and not the state.
Right. I mean, this is I think, like, a deeper, this is deeper than the idea of neoliberalism. What it is it is a way of shrouding and creating some type of narrative that markets are not a function of the state. They are. They exist because of the state. Currency is a function of the state. Your money, you know, they say it's not the government's money. Yeah, actually, it is the government's money. It's not your money. You can have it in the bank, but you're just renting it from the government, and you're renting it for the cost of your taxes is basically what it comes down to. Hmm. And so this is just part and parcel of a fundamental misunderstanding of how just about everything that we have as a society is generated and established. And then, you know, people get to walk away with the credit, and the credit in the form of often in times of just like huge profits. And, you know, whether it's Michael Dell or Howard Schultz or whatever it is. I mean, Howard Schultz is whatever. Everything that built his company
was undergirded and underwritten by our taxes.
I will admit, I maybe just wanted to use the phrase Hugh Hefner Viagra boner because I'm very proud of myself for coming up with it. But it certainly seems like this process has accelerated during this phase of capitalism.
That the boners are getting, the Viagra is even bigger.
Well, more and more Viagra.
If we didn't have a free market, how could one visionary go to Italy and see something and think, oh, I can just do this back at home in the United States?
What, now, which,
talking about Trump?
I'm talking about Howard Schultz.
Oh, going to...
that he writes about that in his book, about he got the idea for Starbucks. He literally goes to Italy and, oh, they're drinking coffee in a nice setting.
So he steals their intellectual property.
Basically.
Yeah, so let's make this totally corporatized and put all of those small coffee shops out of business.
Heavily subsidized, those coffees. Those coffees in Italy, too, I can imagine.
I thought you were going to say he copied Berlusconi.
Oh. Well, but maybe.
Yeah.
We also had these guys on for this book, if you remember, American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. And that goes into sort of especially technology and how much of that was basically World War II era investment.
I forgot about that, having that book on, and appropriately so, as it is about America Amnesia.
But, you know, even if, you know, if we can agree on that, you know, how much of the modern world is built just through public investment. I wouldn't discount the fact that there is a great deal of private investment that is driven by the profit motive and markets and so on. I just don't think there has to be. For whatever pharmaceutical breakthroughs of private pharmaceutical capital can just be public breakthroughs. They can be used. You can use public capital for that.
Right. We have no doubt, but that's a function of just we've decided to make it one thing as opposed to another.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. And I think the evidence that government can be just as effective at this is that because it's laid the foundation for so much of that. And you can also just look at the numbers, right? I mean, there's an X amount of dollars that are in research and development. And I would also argue that it can be made better because the number of medicines and just broadly speaking, devices that would increase our health that are simply not profitable to pursue.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, you know, I think is extraordinary. I mean, I just think like, you know, the Lyme vaccine is just, you know, one that always crops up because having lived in an area where there's a tremendous amount of Lyme, there was a Lyme vaccine in the 70s. It was maybe the 80s.
Or you have people with rarer and more difficult to treat conditions, or, you know, you have a situation where someone has a condition that requires a lot of expensive medications in order to stay alive. There's no motive to break that up.
That's why we have a VA. We have a VA because there are unique injuries that come with having a people who you send into war. And the private sector cannot deal with that because it's just not profitable enough.
And, you know, in the United States, billions of decent people raise money to help find cures for various cancers and rare conditions and so on, often through these shady charities. And isn't that just a profound market failure? That is the way we have to finance finding a cure?
Not to mention, it doesn't matter what kind of drugs you have if people can't afford to buy them on the market. Like, we saw what happened with Martin Shkreli. Everyone hated him for jacking up the price of this life-saving drug. But, like, that is what the kind of behavior that is incentivized by this system. Like, it doesn't make any sense on a human level.
Well, on that note, I think I want to say, Virgil Texas, thank you so much for coming by. It was always a pleasure to have you here. People should go out and get your book, even though you didn't bring it with you today.
He did bring one.
He did.
I did bring one.
Why are you hiding it? I don't understand.
It's over there. I'm here.
All right.
Can I do another plug?
Of course.
Right. Tune in to this Sunday during the big game for the Chapel Trap House Counter Super Bowl Halftime Show.
Really?
Yes.
Smart counter-programming.
Yes, because it's like, what is it, Maroon 5 or some crap like that?
I have no idea.
It's going to be dog shit. Don't watch that. Watch our show, which is going to be bigger, and it's going to have bigger stars and bigger special effects. It's going to knock your socks off. And after that, we'll be streaming our coverage of the big game.
Oh, so you're going to be covering the game, too?
We'll be covering the second half, yeah.
Interesting.
And it's a counter-power, if you will.
Where can people...
On the Chapo Trap House Twitch stream, twitch.tv/Chapo Trap House.
And so let me ask you this. How do you, would they not take it down?
What?
How does it work? Like, aren't they're going to be.
Oh, we're not showing the game.
Okay.
You can watch the game on like a television set in your room. We assume you have that covered. I mean, DIY, personal responsibility.
So you're just going to be doing like the play-by-play?
Yes. Yes.
So
we'll have special guests phoning in.
Phoning it in.
Yeah, phoning in, also in studio.
In studio. Okay.
Yeah, Sean and I are going to be there.
Phoning it in.
Because I know so much about football.
So this is like, this happened when I was a kid. You would, you'd watch the Celtics, and then you'd listen to Johnny Most on the radio. All right.
It's like that.
I'm talking to people who all just look like I thought there would be some recognition of what I said, but it was literally.
No. Johnny Most was the inspiration for this.
You just look so good for your age, Sam, that sometimes we forget you're like a million years old.
That's right. I'm just looking around just going, oh, my God. No one. There's probably very few people alive who even know what I'm talking
Matt
about.
Also, we also grew up listening to Johnny Most and the old transistor radio.
Thank you. Well, thank you for not saying tube radio. Folks, just a reminder, this show relies on the support of its members. It's a freebie Friday, so enjoy. But this has been somewhat of a taste of what you can get. Tonight, I think there's some tickets left for the Michael Brooks show, which is at the Bell House. Check it out.
I'll be there.
Matt will be there. I intend to be there unless something... even remotely, vaguely interesting shows up in between now and then. I joke, of course. And Jamie, this week's Antifada.
Oh, yeah. So I really like the episode that we put out this week with Leslie Lee III of Struggle Session, which is an awesome podcast that everyone should check out if for some reason they haven't yet. They talk about pop culture from a leftist perspective. So we talk about The Handmaid's Tale and what it means to resistance libs and why it's so terrible and why so much resistance art, including SNL, is also terrible in this day and age. And then we talk about the Purge movies, which is like just like a breath of fresh air for anyone who wants to watch a drug dealer in the projects and all of his community just murk these white nationalist Nazis that they sent to kill them.
House of the Seven Gables on Literary Hangover. That's the newest episode. Check it out.
All right, folks. See you on Monday. On Monday. Oh, God. Here we go.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.